How do you feel about the idea of, because a tree comes from a seed?
Yeah.
How did this happen? I hate to chicken and egg you here, but there was no trees and there was a tree. How does this happen?
Well, it didn't happen that one day there were trees. Funny enough, there's really no such thing as a tree. But no, I mean, the concept of evolution proposes gradualism to basically everything. You can have, like, their arguments about, like, does punctuated equilibrium happen? But punctuated equilibrium is just, like, the idea that speciation can occur dramatically. But speciation is not the same thing as, different phyla all of a sudden appearing or anything like that.
Okay. I mean, I don't think that's a great answer. Do you guys want to comment on that? That sounded critical. I just think it's like there was no tree, then there had to be tree, like whatever, plant, whatever. It's like without it having a seed initially, and well, then how does it evolve a seed? Both of those are problems. Where does it start?
Good question.
And then how does it get
so? I know very, 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 very little about like the fossil record of plants, and I actually don't know very much about like plant systematics or whatever, but. What I typically like to do in these situations is, like, the fossil record is, like, how many organisms have ever lived? Like, even if we just discount microbes, it's
8.5
trillions.
Million,
it's hundreds of, like, there have been 100 billion probably humans alone. If you go with your guys' model, it's only a few billion probably. But anyway, it's just billions of humans.
Many billions.
We don't have fossils of even remotely close to 1% of all the things that have ever lived in terms of the actual numbers of organisms, or really, I would say, either in terms of species either. But that doesn't mean that the evidence would still conform to some particular proposed mechanism, right? So with evolution, what does it propose? Gradual changes over very long spans of time. And what we find, like with plants, for example, is like angiosperms, those are the most common plants. Those are plants that produce flowers. Gymnosperms are plants that do not produce flowers, but they'll have cones typically, like cycads and ginkgos and evergreen trees and welwitschia, and there's a few others. Then there are, what do you call them? The like, not bryophytes, but whatever ferns are, like spore producing plants. They're vascular, but they're spore producing plants. And then so on and so on. What we find is the oldest plant fossils are not like the plants of today. Like Cooksonia is the oldest one. It's extremely simple. It's a vascular plant, but it has like a false root structure. What do you call roots? They're called like rhizoids or something like that. It doesn't have true rhizoids. It probably used spores. I'm not 100% sure on that, but it doesn't have seeds, and it doesn't have flowers, right? So the oldest fossil specimens of plants are not like modern plants. And so I think that that is consistent with the idea that life changes over time.
I think I'll give you that time. When you're looking at fossils in the order in which we find them from the most buried fossils to the least buried fossils, the plant life does appear to follow a trend line of like sea to land type, like there appears to be the strongest correlation I would give it, supporting the evolutionary paradigm with plants. With animals and sea creatures, though, it's not as clean. Like, for example, you've got highly complex trilobites, you've got cephalopods, the earliest creature fossils we find in the Cambrian explosion are already highly diverse, highly articulated.
In the Ediacaran, which comes before that.
Yeah, so I think that's challenging. That's challenging for the evolutionary paradigm, that even though the correlation with plants seems to be pretty strong, the correlation with complex organic life forms that are non-plants is much more challenging because that diversity appears rapidly right at the earliest point.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a challenge because, again, what we find in those, the fossil record's always going to be incomplete, and over hundreds of millions of years, it's going to be sadly incomplete. But still, what we see in the pattern of those fossils is still consistent with evolution. It's like an example I gave like last week or something. Do we know, or do we have the very first brick that was laid in the building of Rome? Do we have that brick?
That I don't know. Maybe.
I don't. I don't think Vatican's we do. Got it. I don't think we do. In the basement Rome. Of the Vatican. Oh, sorry. So maybe in the basement of the Vatican. Yeah. pretty sure all the world's secrets are there. So I could argue. I think this would be silly, but I think it's kind of the same logic. All of our evidence points to Rome suddenly being created in a fully mature city as a fully mature city state. We don't have the first brick or the first building. So what would you say to that argument?
I would say that Rome was built by intelligent minds.
Well, I would also say it's not analogous.
Evolution could be intelligently guided as well. That doesn't matter. But truth over tea, what'd you say?
Well, I was saying it's not really analogous because it's not bricks aren't living organisms. And it's not like going through... the brick analogy, I can see what you're getting at, but I don't think it would be a fair analogy to the discussion. Just because they're not living organisms. They have no capability beyond being built by the builders, you know, in the limits that those builders have.
But what we're talking about is, does the physical evidence suggest that a thing was all of a sudden created, or that the thing... Now, we won't ever have direct, like, we won't ever have the entire record, the continuous record of every single step that happened. But does the evidence, I forgot where I started with that, but does the evidence indicate that there are stages that this has gone through? I would argue the archaeological record clearly shows that, although at no point in the record do we ever have, like, the first of anything, or, like, it's, like, literally the genesis of the thing. And the fossil record, we're never going to have that either, but the fossil record, if you ask me, clearly demonstrates stages of changes, I guess.
I would disagree, because transitional fossils, like, you don't go from a rat to a bat, and you don't have a series of brat fossils in between the two.
Well, bats didn't evolve from rodents.
Bats are rodents.
No, they're not. Bats are... they're the second largest group of mammals, actually, and they are... It starts with a C. What the hell are they called? Bats are...
Well, somebody in high school biology failed me, because I always thought they were rodent class.
That's fine. No, they are... Oh my god, what are bats called? We're not doing anything until I figure this out. Chiroptera.
You're stalled.
Chiroptera. Oh, yeah, okay. I had to know what it was. But no, bats aren't rodents. But, I mean, I would say we do have... getting into transitional fossils will be kind of a separate... It's the same topic, but kind of a separate thing. So I just kind of want to stick on just the fossil record in general, I guess.
Well, see,
for now.
I feel like the fossil record is kind of like... I hate to be that guy, but to me it's just like, okay, you can try to draw a conclusion from it, but ultimately the first thing you see is, okay, this is a dead animal, right? These are bones of a dead creature. I think a lot of the conclusions drawn are based off of philosophical presuppositions. Like, we have to, so like, for example, how the fossils are laid, or how old the geological strata really is. Because the fossil record from the conventional paradigm, it has to match the long period of time, right? And so we have to determine, well, if it laid out...
It doesn't have to.
Well, it would... Like, it couldn't have happened 5,000 years ago on the conventional paradigm. Let's say, like, a velociraptor obviously would have had to...
Well, it could have, but the evidence doesn't look like it did. It is the big thing.
So... What I'm saying is, so if we take out all philosophical presuppositions and we look at the geological strata, there's actually, if you're interested, Eric, you should watch Is Genesis History just came out with a second documentary, and it's on rock folds. It's specifically focused on geology. I don't know, like, how interested you are in geology, but if so, just like, and it's straight up them doing...
How dare you?
Well,
that's a megalodon tooth right there. How dare you?
I can't see it with the small screen on my old iPhone 8. Okay. So, anyways, in the video, they go through how they do their experiment to test the age of the rock. They show you like how there's ooids in this rock and all sorts of just cool stuff about the rock fold and their theory and model and how it folded. I think you'd be interested in watching it because it's a very good way to show the science behind what the young Earth creation model is from a flood perspective. And so when we assume that, well, this strata, I think that's a big problem for the conventional paradigm is rock folds, because how did this sediment over a short, you know, long period of time go in this folding shape and like stay like the vertical side, right? How did that happen? How did this sediment just stay?
How do you anticlines and synclines form? Like, you're talking about rock strata that goes like this and then like that.
Yes. How does that happen? Or even just like
how does that happen in 1 year? That's a monumental hurdle to try to overcome because rocks are brittle.
Well, not if they're wet. If it's a slurry solution, you could totally do it.
Can we not do that?
You can't make mud form. How do I say this? Mud can't do that. You can't fold mud like that because it wouldn't preserve its layers because you're basically talking mud is a liquid.
So how does it over? I guess Dan's pulling up an image here, but over millions of years, how does this vertically aligned dirt stay vertical and not fall? You see what I'm saying?
Well, the layers were lithified solid rock before they got, you know, warped by moving plates is how. It's not that sediment gets laid down. We have like loose sediments that aren't lithified yet, and then some tectonic action happens. That would cause all the sediments to move. They're solid rock before they get warped by tectonic activities.
So how are they in a like rounded shape? Like how do they not crack? You know, like split. When they
so bend there's
or fold.
It's called. Well, they can fold. So it may be metamorphism. Like if you look up like folded mountains, which basically what we're seeing here is analogous to most of that. But rocks have. Any solid material has some sort of plasticity to it. There's stress and then there's strain, mm-hmm. right? So you can stress a rigid material and you can deform it. Now, if you hold that material for long periods of time, the deformation you've caused it can be permanent. And then if we just keep adding more and more strain, then you can continue basically that same pattern. It's kind of like how, I mean, like you can do this with wood. If you have a warped piece of wood, you can put it under weight and like straighten it out. Or like if I took my phone to my pantry, you would see that the boards there look like this, right? Because they've been, if they were brand new and I took all the stuff off of them, they would rebound back to what they originally were. But at this point, they don't. They've been, it's called plastic deformation, I think, when that happens, when it's like permanent or whatever. So.
But does rock have that same like pliability?
Quality.
Like, it seems like it wouldn't. Like if that much.
I mean, it seems like it wouldn't. But we find these things in nature. But the idea that I don't know what the alternative idea is supposed to be. That during a flood, which laid down sediments, which weren't one unified solid thing, that could have caused like ripples and waves and folds. I don't think that holds together at all, because if you take those layers and you try to like warp them or squish them, they're not going to act like a solid body, because they're not. They're individual particles.
So, well, Dan, I know you've been trying to talk because you got stuff pulled up there. Were you trying to say something?
These are just examples. Like this is the wave in Utah. So from an old Earth or uniformitarianistic perspective, this is horrifying to the geologist. It's very difficult to explain. With a flood paradigm, if you have large amounts of strata mixed with water and not fully dried out and solidified yet, the movements from the tectonic plates and isostasy, where it's going up or down, stuff like that, you've got tons of potential energy to play with that can help explain these features. So I would just kind of be curious. And I know geology is not going to be your forte, but I think the reason geology is being brought up so much, Eric, is that, yeah, the fossils are great, but that's only part of the story. The strata itself we find them in also gives us a clue into how they were displaced, to what happened to that living creature that got it packed into the strata that we find it in.
Well, it's also how we date them, too. Like, you can't date fossil bones with, like, potassium argon dating.
No, not the bones. You have to date igneous rocks.
Yeah, right? So, like, the volcanic rock that they may have been buried under, or something like that. Or just a method that's beyond carbon, because obviously if the conventional paradigm is true, carbon's not, it's not the method you'd want to go to test a 65 million year old plus dinosaur.
No, not at all.
So that's why, and Luke, I know you're like, let's not go just in this chilling direction.
Yeah, no, it's all good.
That's always, whenever I think of fossil record, that's always like my first thing. It's kind of like I almost feel like it's putting the cart before the horse. That's why I like to talk about the geology first. Does that make sense? I mean, or am I
correct? Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. I have a friend who's an actual geologist, and it'd be cool to do one of these with him at some point. I'm perfectly happy to talk about geology, but we're not really talking about evolution if we're talking about geology. So, I mean, I don't really care. I guess I think it would probably be better for those watching
maybe if we talked about evolution. Let's maybe come back to geology. Eric had a question about the fossil record. I think we should hit that for a second. I made a few notes. So you say the fossil record supports evolution, and I think it certainly doesn't. Earlier you mentioned however many life forms there are. It's 8.5 million living species on the Earth right now, a million of those being plants. Of the 7.5,
not plants. Insects are by far the most.
I said a million of those are plants. I didn't say that. What was most? A million of this 8.5 living, a million of plants. Of 7.5, yeah, we got the bacteria and things, but fossils, marine life is a huge, huge amount of that. Like land fossils or land animals, it's a very small amount, like less than 50,000. Doesn't matter. We have these very hard to explain conundrums inside of what should be, well, the fossil record is self-evident. Look, this proves evolution. First one that comes to mind, the Cambrian explosion. We have a huge leap. You mentioned punctuated equilibrium earlier, which is what Thomas Henry Huxley liked. You go from basically whatever, the most simple organisms to cephalopods. The Cambrian explosion is a big problem in the fossil record. And however the cephalopods came onto the scene, you have exceedingly complex organisms at the very beginning. Multiple brains, multiple hearts, chameleons. They change their skin pigment. I mean, these things are borderline almost alien, which is why...
Yeah, but we have no idea if they could do that during the Cambrian, but...
Well, that's another part of it is we obviously don't know what their attributes were, but they seemed physically very similar to what we have today. In the article, the paper in Progress in Biophysics and Molecular Biology, it's called Cause of Cambrian Explosion, Terrestrial or Cosmic, a group of scientists got together to expound on Fred Hoyle and I forget the Indian scientist's name. I always have a hard time with their name, but the cosmic biology theory, because the life forms are so complicated so quickly, they don't think that the Darwinian model can possibly explain this. I don't think it matches what you said. It's like we go from simple to complicated. We don't really. We go from marine life, which are obviously very simple, to extremely advanced marine life very quickly, and I think that's very hard. I think that's one problem with the fossil record is the huge rapid progress leaps that isn't answered by Darwinian evolution. The next one is living fossils.
Well, I got one on Cambrian, and then let me write down living fossils so we don't forget it.
Wickramasinghe is the name of the Indian scientist. I apologize. I can't. Chandra Wickram. But anyways, you guys should read that article.
Yeah, as well. Anyways, are there any modern organisms preserved in the Cambrian fossil record strata?
Yeah, what did you say? The horseshoe crab, right? Looks like it.
And the coelacanth.
Coelacanths, you can't find those in
I thought you said living fossils. Sorry.
No, are there any living organisms of today found in the Cambrian fossil?
That's a good question.
Yeah, no, that's not
that's a good question. I would, isn't horseshoe crab guy, like, I thought he's the one.
Or maybe that's just trilobite.
So, I don't remember when the Cambrian is. Cambrian period. Let's look it up. It is. It's from, it is. What? From 541 million to 485 million. And so the oldest horseshoe crabs are almost that old, but not quite. What I do know is I researched horseshoe crabs for my book. So when we say that we're going to kind of transition into living fossils here, I guess. But when we say a blank is a living fossil, we just mean representatives of its like group. It's not genus and species. It's not that. Those can be found in the fossil record. So for horseshoe crabs, there are only like two species around today. I'm pretty sure neither of them we have fossils that far back. They're just things that look like them, right? But they're so different. And it's the same for... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I interrupted. You go.
It's the same for coelacanths, but we'll get to the living fossils here in a second. But so the horseshoe crab, if that's not in there, because the conventional secular science tells us that the Cambrian ended, it looks like about 40 million years before that. No modern day organisms exist in the Cambrian strata, and none of them exist in the Ediacaran, which comes before that. Again, that's consistent with evolution. The fact that the oldest fossils are not things that we see today. And even if we find living fossils, there's a separate argument for that, so I guess I can wait. But that's why I brought that up. It is consistent, actually, with evolution. Even if suddenly they appear, just like in the archaeological record, Rome suddenly appears, I don't think that that's good evidence that therefore, they were suddenly created at some point.
Okay. I think just going off of that hyper-focused piece of information, if the only thing we're looking at is one data point, yeah, like, but I think just looking at a zoomed out view, we're trying to take the conglomeration of all these different principles and disciplines, right? We're looking at geology. We're looking at astronomy. We're looking at, human history and things of that nature, and trying to make sense of the whole picture rather than just saying, well, based on this one discipline in science, I'm going to draw my conclusion.
Okay. I got to respond to this really quick. Just, I made a note of what Eric said. That finding animals fully formed doesn't mean that they were made fully formed. That's your argument, right? Yes, it doesn't. But it also doesn't mean that it happened through some sort of evolutionary process. I would almost say finding them fully formed is a better argument, is that they started fully formed if you have no evidence of them not being fully formed. I think it's a bad point to bring because the inverse is more, I think, following Occam's razor, is more logical. Yes, we don't have evidence that it means that they evolved. We don't have evidence that it means they didn't. They didn't evolve, but it's not a strong argument. Anyways, the answer to this really quick: sponges, jellyfish, and anemones. Those were all Cambrian and they're alive.
Well,
but not the ones that we have today. Yeah, I mean there are. Yeah. You could say that's kind of like saying, oh well, dinosaurs are reptiles, and we have reptiles today. That's not. It's really not analogous.
Horseshoe crab-like creatures were in the Cambrian, not the exact horseshoe crab we find in the Chesapeake Bay today.
Yeah, but I mean, that's consistent with evolution.
Well, that would be consistent with young Earth creation too, though. Like, it wouldn't harm but either view.
No, well, I don't think so, because if the Cambrian contains no life that we see today, and all life was created at the same time, and virtually all life perished at the same time, then you would find, then the fossil record would not be stratified the way it is.
So,
unless it was all produced by catastrophic mega tsunamis.
No, not at all. That still isn't true.
So I'm just saying, like, the time, like, so if Noah's flood happened, right? If we look at it from the direct literal sense where all of the creatures that needed to be went on the ark, you know, and the species that were meant to survive did, and this, you know, fat creature that we find, the trilobite horseshoe crab-like creature, it's not necessarily trilobite, that's what they think it is, but it could be something different that's found in the Cambrian. It's just got the, what do you call those things? Claspers. And then it kind of has a similar shape to it. So something like that could speciate into a horseshoe crab in that time, in 4,000 years.
Okay. So I'm pretty sure what you're saying is the life before the flood could have contained species that no longer exist, and the life and species today could be the descendants of different species that were on the ark that didn't yet exist.
It's not
hyperspeciated, basically.
It's not necessarily the case that all sea life died in the flood, right? It's very possible that a trilobite.
But a couple of represented species did, though.
So I'm specifically talking about sea life here. Like they, there's no reason to believe that they all died during the flood. I mean, if anything, they could survive in a flood. It may be a little tough, but they could survive. And so I'm just saying it would not contradict the young Earth model. It can still fit. Seeing the horseshoe crabs that we see today, 4,000 years is enough to speciate. I mean, look at the types of dogs that we see today as opposed to a wolf, right? If we can go from a wolf to a Pomeranian in a couple hundred years of humans interfering with artificial breeding, 4,000 years of natural selection and genetic mutation could definitely lead to a horseshoe crab.
Yeah, I feel like what we're doing, though, is we're saying, look, it's possible, and almost anything, somebody that believes in, I don't know, we could get somebody from some faraway land that has their own creation myth that's wildly different. And they could probably make some sort of argument that it's possible that what we see could reflect that. But we're not really arguing whether or not the data represents it. We're just arguing whether or not the data says it's literally impossible, which I don't think is a very strong position to be arguing from. That was something I was going to say. Now I don't remember what it was.
I've got a really cool data point. I'd love to see what you have to say about this, Eric. So here's just off a hunch, right? I'm going to flip my camera around for a little bit. Off a hunch, I was like, well, what is the oldest shit on the planet? Living things. Like documented living animals, creatures, fish, I don't care. What's the oldest stuff? And first I was just looking at land animals. Just let's see what's on land, has breath in its lungs. Let's look at some life expectancies. And so I've got, this is on...
That's what you mean by oldest?
Can you tell me that
the bristlecone pine tree is 5,500 years old or whatever? Is that where this is going?
Well, before we get to plants, I just want to talk about animals, fish, non-plants. So looking at recorded mammal lifespans in captivity on average, antelope 15 years, badger 15 years, camel 40 years, and all these data points you're looking at like 25, 20, 50, 50, 70, 10, 41, 50, there's not a lot of outliers in the data set. On average, you're looking at about 30-ish years for all these domestic land animals. Then going on to birds, we see 22, 52, 80, and the golden eagle, that's interesting. So on 50, 35, there's no outliers that are really going way above and beyond other than the box turtle here at 123. Blows everybody else out of the water.
Galapagos turtles can live to be like 500 years old.
And that's what's interesting. So now... just looking at your generic land creatures, I don't care what area you're looking at, all tend to have similar lifespans. They die around the same time. Now we're going in the ocean. These particular clams, ocean quahogs, average 200 to 500 years old. Those things live a long time. Ocean quahogs live in the Atlantic and can live more than 400 years old. At 507 years of age, Ming, the clam, broke the Guinness Book of World Records as the oldest animal in the world. Ming clam was dredged off the coast of Iceland in 2006. Ming was born in 1499 and died in 2006. That age was calculated by counting annual growth lines in the shell. All right, what else we got? A certain kind of coral, which I'm not as interested in. Immortal jellyfish. The Turritopsis dornil, the immortal jellyfish. No bigger than half a centimeter, lives in the seas across the world, like, has two forms. Unique ability to revert to its younger polyp form after reaching its fully grown state.
Shadow, does any of this support your argument?
It does. I'm getting.
Can we get to the point then? Because this is taking a very long time.
So what I'm getting at is why? Why is it that ocean life, such as certain types of fish, whales, appear to have the ability to not die of old age, far unlike anything else that draws breath on the land?
No whale has that. There's the immortal jellyfish. There are some people think that lobsters can't die of old age. They can obviously be killed, but they can't die of old age and stuff like that. But no mammal has that ability. So
that's an what does that have to do with anything? This is what it has to do with it. Let me flip my camera back around. Now, if, for example, there was a worldwide cataclysm some odd 5,500 years ago, and none of the ocean life experienced a drastic genetic bottleneck, but the creatures that draw breath did and were brought two by two onto a vessel that saved them from that cataclysm, one would expect to find that the catastrophic genetic entropy as a result of inbreeding from that genetic bottleneck at the time of that cataclysm would have an effect on overall life expectancy.
Why?
So the trend line, if...
Why would inbreeding decrease life expectancy?
Have you seen the royal families?
What effect...
about the Whitakers?
What effect does it have on life expectancy?
Why should one family not on an island keep inbreeding with themselves? What is the end result
of that?
Because
it increases the rate of recessive alleles, which can be lethal. What... Uh-huh. Yeah, so what effect on life expectancy would that have?
I would shorten it.
What data do you have that supports that?
What? Did you hear the whole last 10 minutes? it's just a simple argument.
If what he just said was the supporting data, then that was a circular argument where you began with the conclusion. What actual data do you have to support that? Why would land breathers aquatic land breathers, why would aquatic air breathing animals die at a more rapid rate during a global flood than ones that don't? That makes no sense at all. I'm going to go off the app for a second.
Sure.
That's surprising he didn't understand the argument.
Where'd he go?
We'll see if we could bring him back in.
He said he's got to jump off the app. I think it's like a call or something. Like,
I'm just using the evidence I'm seeing is that there appears to be a trend that ocean-dwelling life does not appear to have the same problem as far as life expectancy that land animals do. They're in just a totally different ballpark of not dying of old age.
Do you know that octopuses, you know what the maximum life expectancy of an octopus is?
We can look at it,
actually.
It's like 5 years.
No.
So,
yes,
Eric,
it is.
Are you saying, Eric, that inbreeding does
I just read a book
not,
about octopuses.
Are you saying inbreeding does not affect life expectancy?
Like, extreme inbreeding could, but I'd like to see data that says I can understand how it would, like, if it increases recessive lethal alleles, that's something that's probably going to kill something before it even develops. You know, like King, what was that guy with the horrible face? I don't remember. The inbred king, you know.
Oh.
I don't think he died all that young. Dang, what was his name? Inbred king. Or he was a prince, actually. Oh, yeah, Charles II.
Chuck the Ugly.
So, because if I look up, if you just Google, does inbreed...
Oh, yeah, he died kind of young. But he was a really extreme case. Anyways, sorry.
The study comes up right away on the National Institute of Health. That analysis shows the inbreeding effect on lifespan is not good. And then, like, if you just go down, there's tons of literature that says this.
Right, it's just, let me simplify that. I'm just going to be kind of the game show host here. It's just another logical, easy to grasp argument for what we would predict if the flood happened. You have, according to the Bible, people were living a very long time before the flood. We don't know how long the animals were living, but maybe a very long time. The animals didn't experience this excessive genetic bottlenecking, you know, where you reduce all of these, you know, whatever genetic information is there to more mutated and then quickly more mutated after that because of the bottleneck. You would expect that the flood would have caused the land animals that were reduced down to 2 or 4 or 6 or whatever to have a shorter life expectancy, and that the marine animals who didn't have this experience because they lived through the flood to not have it. It's like, it's not like bingo bongo, we got you proof. We were just like, you were saying the fossil record proves evolution or is evidence for it, which we don't think it is. We've, you know, gives a good refutation, but this is just a good argument that Dan brought up that a lot of people don't think about. This is evidence in favor of, like, why else?
So that argument came with like an insanely large amount of baggage that we now have to go through. Like, for example, octopuses have a life expectancy. Like you said, things that live in the water but don't breathe air have longer lifespans. And that isn't true. Like bony fish, which make up by far the largest group of organisms in the ocean, they don't have abnormally long lifespans. Some have very short ones, some have long ones. The average, I would like to see how the average compares to terrestrial vertebrates. It could be a few years more.
Dude, you said the turtle. For example, the turtle was like 500 years. The turtle might have lived through the flood too. I didn't think about that.
I
don't get what the argument is. And then the other thing is, why the hell would aquatic air-breathing animals have died at a greater rate during a flood and then gone through a bottleneck?
I don't think he said that. Because the turtle was an example that he used.
Yeah.
That means that wouldn't have gone
through. Well, you said there was a bottleneck.
Yeah, so it wasn't for aquatic animals.
Not for aquatic air-breathing animals either?
Just aquatic in general.
Aquatic in general.
Okay. I thought you said that it worked that way, but I guess I misheard. Totally possible.
Maybe misheard. So the position we're going to take, right, is young Earth creationists from a biblical framework is if it says it in the text, we have to use that as a presupposition. If it doesn't say it in the text, we get to pick our presupposition and build a model. Right, but like the core framework is we're going off of the Torah, the ancient Hebrew Bible. And in the written history that we believe is actual history, Noah was commanded to take a male and a female of each animal that has breath and 7 pairs of clean animals. So that gets your like sheep, cows, stuff that they were going to eat for food. So that would be the genetic bottleneck we're expecting to see if that model's true. Such a commandment was not given for aquatic animals because he didn't put any aquatic animals on the ark, only ones that draw breath. So likewise, the ones in the ocean just were fine. The flood didn't seem to bother them too much. You wouldn't have a drastic decrease in population you would expect to see.
I need to see data that says that like terrestrial animals have drastically shorter lifespans on average than aquatic organisms. I get like Greenland sharks live to be like 400 years old. That's an extremely long time. But they live in extremely cold waters. They have very slow metabolisms. I think it makes sense why they live so long. And, you know, there are some land animals that only live a couple of years. Like mice, even ones that are kept under domestication, only live a couple of years.
Yeah.
But there are some bony fishes that only live for a few years. Octopuses, their life expectancy is like 5 years, except for a couple of, maybe like one or two species.
Yeah, that octopus
thing. And then, thing, and then like Galapagos tortoises are like, can be like 400 years.
Reproduction. That's sorry, like what? The octopus thing has to do with they're basically dying through reproduction. It's not because they have like a cellular degenerative thing. It's part of their reproductive processes. They reproduce once and die. So it might just be spawning.
Yeah, well, that's their life expectancy. That's their biology.
Right. That doesn't necessarily mean aggregated mutations. It means just the kind of their functionality. But I just Googled, do land animals or marine life live longer? Some long-lived, this is the first thing. Some long-lived marine animals can live strikingly longer than any terrestrial ones. So that's the first one that comes to it. But I'm going to look through some more of this. I think generally it's accepted that the longest living animals in the ocean live far longer than the ones on the land, such as whales.
But that's just that's just the tail end of a normal distribution. That's not going to inform you about the overall data set. We don't use outliers to explain the entire data set.
Right.
Yeah, but I think that's more fair, just but like this would fit better with the having the bottleneck specifically for the terrestrial animals. Like it's not like we've won, right? This is just like, this seems to fit a little better in the creation, young earth creation model, flood creation model, as opposed to the conventional paradigm.
Right,
like,
Eric.
What would the explanation be other than just coincidence and then, you know, for on the conventional paradigm? It's not that it doesn't fit.
I still think there's a lot of baggage. Why are there, like, why are there marine fossils? Why would a flood kill marine organisms?
Before you talk about that, Dan, I think, Eric, the better response to this thing isn't to say ocean animals don't live longer. I think it's better to just say it's like what they're saying here. It's easier for them because they have less of a chance to die of freak accidents is what they're saying. I mean, everybody knows they live longer in the aggregate. However you want to parcel this data, you take them all what lives the longest in the aggregate, what lives longest, marine animals live longer. I think the better thing isn't to say it doesn't happen. It's to say that it's because they're in the ocean and they're not going to get, you know, killed by an earthquake or a meteor or something. I think that's an easier way to cover that because they do live longer. I mean, just kind of objectively. Anyways, go ahead, Dan. Do you want to talk about the fossils, the marine fossils? Because I would love to get Eric's take on how he thinks any marine fossil forms without a flood. But, Dan, this is your specialty.
Yeah, no, let's go. So I'm going to be mainly looking at the I didn't want to flip my camera like that. Or did I? Yes, I did. I didn't want to take off this effect for a little bit. So one of the core mechanics that we as a young Earth global flood model geophysicists is going to use, because you have to have a driving mechanism. You can't just fling continents around at the speed that you can run for fun. You've got to have a driving mechanism. And the driving mechanism that we're going to use is going to be the Creation Week ocean floor, which is now plunged into the Earth's mantle, which is fun. This is a paper from 2018. Researchers at CU Boulder report that they may have solved a geophysical mystery pinning down the likely cause of the phenomenon that resembles a wrench in the engine of the planet. In a study published in Nature Geoscience, a team explores the physics of giant slabs. These geophysical oddities form when huge chunks of Earth's oceanic plates are forced deep underground at the edges of certain continental plates. These chunks sink down to the planet's interior for hundreds of miles until they suddenly, and for reasons they can't explain, stop, like a stalled car. So this is just a thing about our planet that isn't very uniformitarianistic. That, unlike this graphic, it's not just really consistent all the way around, liquid, and then leveled out based on density of the matter. In fact, there's unconformities, very large packets of crust that are in this that have not yet liquefied and then settled out. So
you're implying that those plates, the way you presented that was as if to where your mouse was pointing was something like 2,000 miles below the surface. The lithosphere does not extend below the asthenosphere, which is only a couple hundred miles below the surface at the most. Also, what does this have to do with fossils?
We'll get there. So I was talking, to do the flood, we need a driving mechanism. Now, as you'll notice, they write here, the stoppage is likely temporary, although we see these slabs stagnant. They're fairly recent as a phenomena, probably happening within the last 20 million years, said Zhang, a co-author of the new study. So based on the physics, they're saying these have to be recent within the last 20 million years. Now, on a...
Therefore, the Earth is 6,000 years old? Therefore, dramatic crustal disturbances happened 4,000 years ago, because some features may be 20 million years old?
Well,
That can't be your argument. Secular science says that parts of the data may only be 20 million years old. Therefore, a global flood happened 4,000 years ago.
So they're going to disagree on the timescale, obviously, but the data set is what we're looking at. The evidence that we didn't put there is young Earth creationists. These relatively young, very large packets of strata in the Earth's mantle. How did they get there, and what was the result on the planet's surface? If these were displaced relatively recently, even if you're going to look at it from an evolutionary timescale, you moved a lot of material fairly recently compared to evolution. Like, you know, if you're saying that
you're off by a factor of 5,000 with your proposed explanation.
Okay, so I'm just gonna, for if you can give me this as a okay, fine. This is how we're moving the continents around, is that the original ocean floor the Earth had has subducted, which is what's moving the plates.
That's not a mechanism. You've just told me something that has happened. The mechanism has to explain how it happens.
Right. So now I'll flip my camera back around. But just to show you, we're not just kind of pulling this out of our butts. There's a... evidence to support that this may have actually occurred. Now, you're familiar with the Pangaea configuration of the continents, right?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So those are our initial conditions as well. In our modeling, still remember, I said if it's printed in the book, we have to use it. And that's in Genesis. He said, let the dry ground appear, and all the waters gathered in one place and all the land in another. And he called the dry land earth, and he called the ocean seas, the water seas. We're still starting with all of the land together in one place, just like Pangaea. It's the same starting conditions. So we're placing that
above. That story was written by people that didn't know other parts of the world existed. To them, the world was where they lived.
Yeah, but this would have been
a far better explanation.
Right.
You have to presuppose that it's the literal inspired word of God, and God is imbuing information that they don't even know about into the story so that later four white dudes could argue about it.
Maybe. It's kind of fun.
I don't identify as white.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
That's going to be a tough sell.
So this is our... this is our initial conditions, that we've got the Pangaea configuration of the continents. And also, it's not written in the text, but part of our modeling, we're going to presuppose that the ocean floor is made of a type of rock that is more dense than the lithosphere below.
Why?
Because it's about to sink based on density.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily have to be density, but why do you have to presume that?
So the driving mechanism for how we're shredding the continents apart and moving them about the speed that you can run in about a year and a half, this is what we're doing here. So let me put another.
This does have to do with where the fossils in the ocean.
This does have to do with where fossils are. So you're familiar with this. This graphic is pretty wide, well, commonly used to explain subduction.
I've seen it before. Comes from McGraw, Pearson. Might be McGraw Hill. I'm not totally sure. I've seen that diagram. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the framework we're setting up for our initial conditions. You've got the Pangaea continents, and you've got a creation weak ocean floor made of a material that is more dense than the lithosphere below. Now,
wait.
It's,
don't you mean that the ocean crust is denser than continental crust?
No, yes, more dense than continental crust.
Okay.
At the beginning.
Well, it still is.
So what's happening is at the beginning of the flood cataclysm, once again, written in the text, in the 600th year of Noah's life, the fountains of the great deep burst forth and the windows of heaven were opened. So that Hebrew word for burst forth is baka, which is like to rift, to cause a break, could be a poetic description of the physical reality of what it would look like if one earthquake fractured the used to be one cohesive continent and the subterranean water that was underneath comes upward. Now, what we're proposing in the model is that earthquake at the beginning of the cataclysm was enough to begin the process of subducting for all of the ocean plates globally at the same time. Now,
are you telling me that because the lithosphere that sinks into the mantle is pulling the plates apart?
The density of the dense material of the ocean floor plates is going to start subducting. So it's more dense than the lithosphere. And once it starts subducting, it'll heat up as it's not only producing friction against the continental plates, but also diving into the lithosphere is going to heat up, which is going to make the rock more viscous. And as it becomes more viscous, it's going to be able to move more freely.
And it'd become less viscous.
Less viscous, more slippery, right?
Viscosity is the resistance that a material has to flow. So the less viscous it is, the more free-flowing it is.
Ah, so I have that flipped. So it's becoming less viscous as this is occurring, which speeds up the rate, which is also going to increase the friction on the continental plate it's rubbing up against, which would increase the heat, which is also going to lower the viscosity.
Okay, never mind. I think I know what you meant, but go on.
Yeah, so this is the driving mechanism for everything we're going to be doing in the Young Earth flood modeling.
Okay. This makes no sense. And I can show you why. This isn't sufficient enough to make this entire thing move.
Keep going. What happens? Wait, we're about to hit it.
It still isn't. There it went.
There it is.
Those are not
That was it.
Those Perfect. Are not the conditions that we have.
Just catastrophically fell off.
Those are not the conditions that we have. The gap between, what should we pick? I mean, you've completely discounted that rising magma from the mantle pushes apart the plates at mid-ocean ridges. I'm confused why you would discount that, because I don't think that necessarily threatens your position, although I think the way the data looks definitely does. But this is talked about in geology. It's called slab pull. And it's a proposed mechanism that assists in the movement of tectonic plates. But you have a tectonic plate that extends maybe a couple hundred miles into the lithosphere, but the plate is like hundreds of thousands of square miles, but it's linearly. I mean, you'd have to talk about square miles because you have to talk about the mass of the plate, but whatever. But linearly, it's much more than that. How on earth, like, unless you have a completely frictionless surface, then having 1% of it or even 5% of it distending down is not going to have sufficient mass to pull the rest of the thing downward.
Now, let's see, how can I put this? Once it starts being pulled downward, based on that mechanism of it heating up, lowering the viscosity, increasing the rate, which increases the heat from the friction, which then continually lowers the viscosity, and you have a self-feeding loop that is eventually going
to
pop up.
But it does nothing to... Oh, jeez. You have... So down here where it's subducting, you have all that good old friction and stuff happening, right? What about the hundreds of thousands of square miles over here? Nothing at all is being done to counteract to negate the friction of hundreds of thousands of square miles of ocean crust and continental crust sitting on top of the asthenosphere. And the asthenosphere is not, it's not magma, it's a plastic solid. It deforms, but it's not really a liquid. But even if it was a liquid, this is still enormous amounts of friction to try to overcome. In fact, funny enough, if you like took a garden hose that was like, I don't know, 30 feet long, and you tried to blow the water out of it, you wouldn't be able to. Not because your lungs aren't strong enough to push that weight of water, but because the water actually creates friction against the surface of the hose. So 30 feet might be too short, a little bit longer than that. But even if we have a liquid mantle below and a lithosphere on top, that's still way too much friction. This slab pull mechanism is not, this doesn't make any sense. Again, and I don't know why you don't just assume that the rising magma, which pushes apart plates at divergent boundaries, like mid-ocean ridges, I don't know why you wouldn't just presume that that happened at an accelerating rate.
Well, we are. It's just that's not the cause. That's the result. It's dependent on the material being put into the lithosphere.
How is rising magma creating rifts in the... How does this, thousands of miles away, cause magma to... Well, you're saying it pulls it apart so the magma just fills in the space.
Correct.
I guess that's probably what you would be saying. I don't think you have anything here that can explain why plates move at all.
You're saying that you don't believe this is a sufficient explanation
for plate movement? No. 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 I'm gonna grab my bottle of wine. I will be right back.
You need the bottle.
I ran out.
I've got Eric.
He ran out.
See, now I want to do that.
Adam, you got anything on this? I'm not I'm not good at young Earth geology.
No, the flood model, I've just not taken the time.
Teacher's back. Stop talking about it.
Take notes. I don't know
teacher's
why.
Teacher's back with wine.
I'm more of the philosophical.
You goddamn kids! You did this to me!
Go back to the old school where that would be tolerable. So I don't know much about...
I don't think that was ever tolerable.
Younger, I'm sure it was like... I just imagine like some teacher with like with his jack. I think that was the thing.
Oh, dude,
like
they had mini fridges 50 years ago under their desk. Are you kidding me?
That's funny.
I'm sure they did. So I don't know much about the especially the CPT model, and I have issues with it, in particular the heat problem. I have to debate that quite a bit. I think that it's a decent model, and I think that if we had the NSF and you know, all the king's horses and all the king's men. I think we could put together a better model over time. But I think the important part of that is how does how that initially started. It's like the second time Eric's asked a question about fossils, and then it flies into geology. But the question about how we have marine fossils, I just covered it on my last video. How are fossils formed, largely? The vast majority of fossils, how are they formed?
They get buried in sediment, and then...
Right, that's all.
There's a lot more to it than that.
Wait.
And then the organic tissue tends to disappear, although we get some cool specimens like the nodosaur that they found in Montana a few years ago. Right. But the bone is spongy, and so water rich with minerals gets in there, and then the minerals precipitate out, and then the it's basically rock in the shape of some of the tissues that were buried.
Right. So, but the key thing I was looking for there is that it's rapidly buried, basically through mud or, you said, sedimentation. Something encases the animal, it rapidly buries it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, an event doesn't have to happen for that to happen. Like, we know that, like, a lake or
a river.
Sometimes rivers or the ocean. I mean, the sediment can be tens, if not hundreds of meters deep. So something can die and simply fall into sediment. There doesn't have to be an event.
Simply, this is exactly occurs. What I've been covering. Simply.
There's too many fossils to just say.
Simply like... fall. You know, what could happen is it could have died of natural causes and fell in a mud pit. That could have happened everywhere around the world. It doesn't matter if there was a lake there or a stream there or not. It could have happened. Like, the idea of just explaining every fossil on the earth through something dying and then falling into it, or dying and then, you know, a river overtops, or a localized flood. Like, regardless, it's going to be rapidly buried, and we find the fossils all over the earth, obviously in every corner of the earth. I don't think it's square. The marine fossils are interesting because you ask, how does any marine fossil form? It's like, well, it dies and then it falls.
No, that's not an issue. Why would a global flood have killed so many things?
Okay.
Or so if they didn't die during the flood, why are there so many of these fossils?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked that. So with this kind of mechanism that we're using to scientifically describe what this global catastrophe may have entailed, as these plates are starting to subduct, the subsequent earthquakes that are happening just off the coast of each of the land masses are going to begin small, and they're going to increase in not only frequency, but also in scale. As the plate is increasing in speed due to that kind of circular self-feeding process we were explaining earlier, that initially you'd have smaller earthquakes that are causing smaller tsunami pulses that are still inundating, and as that tsunami pulse comes in, is dragging marine life, dumping it, depositing it on land. And then as the water recedes back into the ocean basin, some of those marine fossils, still living creatures at the time, would be buried in the same sediment that they were dragged up on shore with.
If that happened, we somehow have the most curious case of selective tsunamis, because, like, the trilobites, right? No trilobite fossil has ever been found alongside the remains of any Jurassic or Cretaceous creature. Well, Jurassic creatures aren't found mixed among Cretaceous creatures either. Nor are they found mixed among the remains of some sort of other intertidal zone organism, or I don't remember my ocean geography very much, but, like, today in these areas, we have seals, and we have otters, and we have bottlenose dolphins, and, like, orcas, and whatever else. Like, obviously, some of those things will go out to the deep ocean, but they'll be close to the shore, too, especially, like, the seals and the otters and things like that. We don't find, if a worldwide cataclysm was occurring, everything living in these environments would have died at the same time. Now, I've heard the argument that the waters slowly rose, so it killed off certain ecosystems, one and then the other and then the other. And that's why the distribution of fossil, that's like why, for example, secular science tells us life originated in the oceans, because there are no land fossils until like 500 million years ago or whatever it is. And that's the explanation. However, the organisms living in the oceans would have all died at the same time, therefore. But we have an extremely well sorted out period of marine fossils as well. Like, without repeating too much, you don't find trilobites mixed among ichthyosaurs, for example. Which makes no sense if all these things were dying in cataclysms that were occurring at the same time. Or cataclysm occurring at the same time.
I mean, just something that comes to mind is like the, I don't know, this was just a different fossil. I'm going to try and pull it up. But what about the dinosaur monument? Isn't there, I want to pull up the data on that one.
As you pull that up.
But I'm familiar, I think that's one. That's
this isn't my area of expertise, but... my understanding is either Dan's model or whatever, we have this intense tsunami waves emanating from fault lines. Just, you know, just like we have today when there's a tsunami. Like, you know, you have like a earthquake and then you have this tsunami wave. But these ones were massive, 100 times larger, 1,000 times larger, whatever. So you have this.
Would have destroyed a wooden boat, by the way.
A buoyant wooden boat. That's another conversation. Let's talk about that though in a second. That's a good idea. So the idea would be a swell and a movement of water and a movement of mud. And what would have happened is all of the land-based, seafloor-based marine animals would have been wiped out with no chance. If you were on foot, you weren't, whether you're on land on foot or in the ocean on foot, a trilobite, which is it's always going to be at the bottom, isn't it? Going to be at the bottom. I don't know. Do they swim around and go to the top and stuff? Or are they mostly on the bottom?
I mean, there were thousands of species of trilobite, but they didn't appear to have all that good flexibility. That's one of the That's one of the
like,
reasons.
Imagine them as like snails, basically. They're like sea snails.
So yeah, probably. Sea snail, some of them maybe could have
like a horseshoe crab. They're not like floating. They're bottom dwellers in shallow water.
Right, so you're going to get them at the bottom in that first wave. They're gone. They're going to be in the first encasement. They're going to be layered at the bottom. I think to me that seems like a pretty evident answer to why we don't find a trilobite with a T-Rex.
So would nurse sharks, which congregate en masse, like on the bottom. Now you could argue, sharks can swim. Yes, but you're just giving a statistical argument of what you would see. But, like, the idea that no organisms that we see today or no organisms that are represented, like, in Eocene layers or Cretaceous layers have ever been found alongside those trilobites tells me that they could not have lived at the same time.
Right. Or here's
kind of the way I look at it. Dan, let me say one more thing, and then I'm going to take a quick break. But I just did the dinosaurs in the Sahara, in Gobero, that Paul Sereno found sticking out of the surface of the ground. Everybody says, well, it was a mountain that uplifted and the mountain blew away, whatever you want to believe that. But you have problems in the fossil record where you have dinosaurs, which should be 200 million years ago, actually above strata of where humans were buried 5,000 to 7,000 years ago. So I don't know about the bottom up part of it, but at the very top, we have dinosaurs where they shouldn't be. It's not an airtight argument. There are discrepancies, which secular science is going to go, yeah, well, that's an anomaly. We know it's not right, but there are discrepancies, including dinosaurs at the surface. There are discrepancies. I don't know about at the bottom.
Just because something's at the surface doesn't mean it's not in an old layer.
Right. You can believe that there was a mountain that blew away, but if you look at my video, they're in the middle of the plains of Gobero, flat as you could see, as far as you could see. It looked like a lake bed. So if you want to believe that there was a mountain there that blew away and eroded away, fine.
Well, the geological layers would have to be like almost horizontal because there's a human right next to it that's lower. So it like even that wouldn't make sense. It just that example, that would be a problem for the the secular view.
Right, and I only say that, I'm not saying that's proof of the flood. I'm saying to be like, we don't see a trilobite with a bottleneck dinosaur, so there's no issues.
Bottleneck dinosaur.
Whatever that argument was.
But bottlenose dolphin.
Whatever. The bottleneck dinosaur.
How much Jesus juice have you drank?
What's the new species created by VOR? Maybe that's what they found in Gobero. It's a bottleneck. Prove me wrong. It was a new creature. I'm like a prophet, paleontologic prophet. There are issues, is my point, and I'll concede to Dan.
So here's just kind of one thing I'm thinking, right? So if the beginning of the flood just decimates your shallow marine life, like trilobite stuff that doesn't have a lot of like locomotion, not a lot of good way to swim away, your bigger sharks, your bigger whales, aquatic dinosaurs can get away from the coasts pretty easily out in deeper water. So I feel like that makes sense that once that ecosystem is decimated by the first like full tilt tsunami blast, dragging it up onto the shore, it doesn't just grow back within a week or a few hours or whenever the next tsunami pulse hits. So it's got buried once and it's gone. It got completely wiped out pretty early on in the flood, which is why you wouldn't see that ecosystem buried again in the next layers up. It gets destroyed once and it's wiped out. Though there is evidence of marine fossils being buried throughout the fossil record. And before, like, I think I wanted to show you the dinosaur monument over in the western United States, which has, I think, clams and stuff buried with a bunch of cool stuff. This, I've been playing this over and over. This is the Pangaea to today continental drift model, just on like a time lapse speed up, which is exactly what we're using in the flood modeling. We're just going to say there's a drastic difference in rate. Now notice that India is the fastest moving continent. That thing is flying compared to the rate the other ones are moving, which I just think is really fascinating. And the ocean floor, like I'll go ahead and kind of concede. I want to show you.
Who's got a cat? Is that VOR?
It's not me.
It must be. I don't care, but
it's got to be his.
By the way, I just want to say it's unfair to the Mosasaurus that there's no such thing as an aquatic dinosaur.
There are no aquatic. A dinosaur is a particular type of terrestrial reptile.
I know, and it's just,
ooh, this is
growing up, I always loved the Mosasaur, and when I learned that, I was very upset. So.
Yeah, it is annoying, but the flying ones, those aren't dinosaurs either. In fact, there are three different classes of marine reptiles from the age of the dinosaurs, the Ichthyosaurs, the Mosasaurs, and the Plesiosaurs. So, anyways.
Ooh, I can get rid of the clouds. So this is the Earth with the cloud cover, which is really pretty. But we don't need that for our discussion, so I'm going to get rid of the clouds. The thing I love about the Google Earth modeling is that you get an idea of like some of the ocean floor stuff. So we were looking at India, how the Indian continental plate was the fastest moving one in that modeling. And the interesting thing is that the subsequent igneous rock that would have welled up during the time of the flood that has since cooled shows that travel path really drastically, which is neat. So just looking at these here on the ocean floor is kind of cool looking.
But what about that is consistent with the idea that this would have happened over the course of a year?
So there's issues with, so like the Himalayan mountain range that we would propose in our modeling is a result that like this mountain range did not exist before the flood. That,
how did it get eroded in 1 year?
By catastrophic erosion, you see, when you take an entire ocean and drain it off the land masses, it does a lot of damage.
What evidence of that do we have?
Dude, have you looked into the Pacific Northwest floods? We've talked about J. Harlan Barrett's find. I was showing this tonight on Google Earth. The Dry Creek Falls is about 100 times the size of Niagara Falls, and that's in the Pacific Northwest that they know was a result of the Missoula floods. They say that the water was 400 feet high at Portland,
And the Missoula floods, that evidence, if you look at it through Google Earth, compared to what you see in the desert Southwest, you see erosion patterns up in the Pacific Northwest, and you can see that there was water damage, and they've conceded giant, massive flooding. And then you look in the desert Southwest, and the flooding is like 1,000 times the size.
Yeah, and I see like the really giant undulations in the land. But what evidence of mass, like that a mountain can be eroded, do we glean from that? Like, let me give you an example. The people that named things in Yellowstone National Park really didn't have very good imaginations, because in Yellowstone National Park, there is a lake called Lake Yellowstone, and there is a river called the Yellowstone River. And there is a canyon called the Canyon of the Yellowstone. And there is a waterfall called the Upper Falls of the Yellowstone. There we go. Mm-hmm. So anyways, we've been continuously observing that waterfall. And a waterfall has the highest possible potential energy for erosion. It doesn't matter if the water is like, let's say, 50 feet deep versus 100 feet deep. Because only the water going over the edge of the rock is going to do anything, right? In the well over 150, well, probably not 150. Actually, at this point, it might be about that. Let's just say 100. Of the 100 years of continuous observation of that waterfall, it hasn't moved an inch. So we see that a waterfall with the highest potential for erosion has not changed something at all by an inch in over 100 years. But deep water moving could erode the Himalayas?
The Niagara River has moved that horseshoe, you know, waterfall back 7 miles. They've been, it's like feet every year.
I don't buy that.
It is. I'll just Google it right now. How much does Niagara Fall recede every year? It's feet. It's, let's see here. 1 foot per year.
This says Niagara Falls has moved back 7 miles in 12,500 years. Mm-hmm. And maybe the fastest moving waterfall in the world. So in 12,500 years, right, a waterfall has moved 7 miles. If you think that scales with, like the water just is draining. I don't know if you're like, obviously there wasn't any erosion happening while the floodwaters were raised. You don't get erosion underwater. It would be as the water drained. And I don't remember exactly. I thought it was maybe like it also took 40 days for the waters to recede, but I don't remember exactly. But if those waters are receding, then like basically the erosion has to happen almost instantaneously because the water is going to drop many feet every single day.
Yeah, you'll have the greatest amount of catastrophic erosion right at the beginning. So, like, for a proof of concept, I would point to something like the Colorado Plateau. That a large amount of strata that used to connect these three massive outcroppings was catastrophically eroded away at the end of the flood. Now, that doesn't mean that all of the flood waters... are gone off the continents right away. You're still going to have these pockets of trapped inland seawater, like Salt Lake, Great Salt Lake, for example. We would posit that the salinity of Great Salt Lake is a result of a trapped inland lake from the flood, as well as there's other sources of water which kind of
but all lakes rough. Would be salt water. Why would only the Great Salt Lake be salt water? How come Lake Superior isn't?
A couple reasons. So Great Salt Lake, for example, I would posit is a result of the flood, whereas other lakes are rainwater from their source, or melted glacial water. It used to be a glacier that melted, which is why it's not salinity. It's gone up into the atmosphere and back down.
How on earth could the Lake Superior Basin exist after the flood, not be filled by any ocean water as the oceans receded, and then later be filled by glacial water?
Okay, that's
I want to answer that. We can answer that. But before we do, I want to just before we move off of this, this is the Niagara Falls, which is receding at 1 to 5 feet per year at this point. And it's been measured for at least 500 years. We know that it's receding.
7 miles at 12,500 years, it's about 3 feet a year.
Yep. And that's after the flood, after the major event, you know, just basically this, the river going through here and carving it. But this, look at the size of this in scale compared to the one that I thought I had pulled up. This guy right here. This is the Dry Falls.
Yeah, but the depth of the water isn't going to matter.
Okay. It is. So watch this.
If you have flowing water, it's only the water that contacts the surface that's going to be able to do anything.
Right. What, I'm going to show you an animation of it. This is great. This is PBS. Okay.
I know. I've seen this video.
What is perhaps the largest flood to ever happen?
This is within the last year this video came out.
At least that we know of. Whatever you're imagining as this flood, you need to think bigger. Much, much bigger. Because the flood that created this and the entire landscape around us.
That's the only one they show you. This is an animation that has been made to kind of show. We were talking about the Niagara Falls and the scale of the Niagara Falls. This is between 100 and 1,000 times the size of Niagara Falls. The amount of water they assume that was rushing over this. This event, the Missoula Lake flood, at Portland, when it hit the Pacific, they estimate, and not young earth creationists, geologists confirm or believe that it was the water was 400 feet deep when it reached Portland. It was like 10 space needles deep, the water was. And this is accepted geology. And this is just a Dry Falls formation. And if I were to take this and look at the desert southwest compared to this, this looks like no rain event compared to what you see going from basically the Rockies down to the Pacific Ocean, which I think was another flood washout. But I just wanted to talk about, we were talking about there's no water erosion from the waterfalls. That's not true. And we have evidence of these things. This one horseshoe right here is like, they think like 70 times the size of Niagara Falls. Total density or total.
How much of it eroded during these floods? Like, are they telling us that the entire area we see in front of us was land as high in elevation as the background, extended all the way to the where the camera is, and then over the course of a few days as that flood happened, all of it got washed away? I've never seen evidence that that's what they claim is the rate at which that this canyon formed, the scab lands or whatever it's called.
And this wouldn't be during the flood cataclysm.
We are not talking about the fossil record. This started an hour ago with the plate tectonics thing. We were supposed to be talking about fossils.
And this is no longer my fault. I know I initially threw it off, but it's no longer my fault.
Temporary Lake Allison was 400 plus feet deep over Portland. It's just crazy. So, like, as far as this, how this goes into the freshwater and the glacial water and the ice age, how this, we have a very good model for all of this quickly, and then we can go on to fossils or whatever. The argument is that after the floodwaters receded and filled into the Marianas Trenches and, you know, slid off the continents, you ended up with water in basins, inland seas, mini oceans, like in the Pacific in the Northwest, in the Southwest. And as these waters wanted to get to sea level, you ended up having catastrophic dam breaking and major washout events happening when, you know, hundreds and hundreds of billions of, you know, whatever gallons of water rush back to the ocean. So you had.
Oh, that.
What's the issue with that?
There's already water in the ocean. So how, like, the only way for what you said to make any sense is if the oceans are empty and all the flood water somehow is on land and then is draining back into the
ocean. The ocean waters were, the ocean level was much lower because all of the water that was in, not a big percentage of the water was rained into the north and into the northern pole, the southern pole, and formed it in glaciers. So we ended up getting an ice age very quickly, and that seawater ended up being.
Are we talking about after the flood?
During and after. Like as the flood is happening, and then just shortly after, the ice age would have been at the end of the flood. And so I covered it in one of my flood videos. They believe that they know that the reason that the glaciers are where they're at, where that water came from, is it came from the ocean. So if you want to go through uniformitarian science, you have to go, well, what caused the ocean water to be dumped in icebergs as glaciers 4,000 feet deep in the North Pole and the Southern and South Pole? we have an event. Heated water caused evaporation. You get the massive lake effect storm, like the global lake effect storm, and you ended up getting, you know, all of that snow redistributed the salt water, the seawater into the glacier areas. So when this happened, the global sea levels were lower until and as those glaciers receded over time, as we reached, you know, back to equilibrium with our temperature, those waters receded, or those the glaciers melted and started filling the water back up. But at one point, you had a lower sea level, which is where all the land bridges would have come into play. You get all the migrations. You don't have to have monkeys rafting from Africa to South America. You actually had lower sea levels. And yes, the water leaving the inland seas would have went to a lower level ocean than what we have right now. It's a cogent theory. I mean, you could disagree with it, but there's no problems with it.
Problems with it.
You haven't provided a single good problem yet.
So let's.
Well, I haven't had a chance to say much for quite a while.
If we want to go back to the fossil record, and sorry, Dan, if you had something you wanted to mention.
I got this neat graphic that I thought of. I wanted to pull up. So just the idea.
I was about to mention this actually, but go ahead.
So this is an excerpt out of the documentary, but they have this really cool graphic that shows the concept we're talking about. Each layer of strata is being laid down all at once in wide packets, one on top of another. And we're just proposing that these happen catastrophically during the flood cataclysm as the land masses are being inundated by these mega tsunamis, dragging shallow or ocean floor strata and just compiling it on land. And the fossils are anything that was alive at the time being buried and killed into those layers. Then, at the zenith of the flood cataclysm, the water is covering all of the land masses by upwards of 50 feet, and that it's going to recede off once the new ocean floor is cooling and sinking back down to its present day depth, which is allowing the water to recede back off the continents. Then you've also got the glaciers that are going to build shortly after that as the oceans cool and you have catastrophic snowfall and precipitation on the land masses. Then those glaciers melt and formed more trapped inland lakes, and you have like the Missoula floods, what Luke was pointing out would be way after the flood, could be a couple hundred years or so after the flood when some of that stuff is even wreaking more havoc on the land masses. So that's where we're putting fossils, buried during the flood, but then maybe exposed by some of these other cataclysms like meltwater floods.
I just don't see how that makes less sense than everything dying and then rivers overtopping.
Because the fossil record is stratified long before anybody had any method for trying to figure out how old anything is. Those words like Cambrian and Ordovician and Cretaceous and Jurassic and Triassic and et cetera. Those words, a lot of them are from the 1800s, because as paleontologists looked at it, they looked at them and they saw, look, the organisms we find in these layers are completely different than the organisms than we find in these other layers. And so like how this all started an hour ago was I was trying to get an explanation for why is we call it the principle of fossil succession, basically. Why does the fossil record read that way if almost everything died if I don't know how long you think it took the waters to rise, because I think it's actually not super clear. In Genesis, did it take 40 days or was it longer than that or whatever? But if everything except for what was on that ark died in 40 days, then why on earth does the fossil record not look like that at all?
So, Dan, I could grab the timeline. This was one of the pieces of evidence I wanted to point out. Are you familiar with the... I think they call it the dinosaur monument. And it's this beautiful outcropping of rock that still has all the fossils in the original strata they were buried in. And I'm going to go ahead and pull up the Genesis timeline as well. Or we could look at what we're really looking at as far as timeline during the like early and later parts of the cataclysm. But there's marine fossils that are buried in with the rest of the, this is like bone graveyard, this grated bed of bones, which is really neat.
So I think as you
go ahead. I asked a question.
So you're asking how the timeline that we're basing
off of. How could everything that wasn't on that ark have died in 40 days and produced a fossil record that is stratified in a way where we have... The reason we have these these names is because the names represent the physical evidence you see in those layers. Nothing in Cretaceous sediments has ever been found amongst the remains of things that are found in Triassic sediments, for example.
Okay, so we're back to where the fossils are found. There's two questions there, and Dan, you can answer one if you want to. But
no, it's the way the fossil record is organized, not where they're found.
The first thing is, we don't believe everything died in 40 days. The process of the flood was over a year. Dan can clarify that a little bit. The waters, happened for around 40 days. Somebody said earlier about the mountains. We didn't have major mountains before the flood. This is all upheaval, uplift, collision, plate tectonics that are causing all of these. So we didn't have to have enough water to cover Everest. Everest was formed in this. And who knows when that really shot up, because they were more in the Middle East, it sounds like. So Everest might have been out there 20 days in, 40 days in, we don't know particularly. But what you had is slow death, all these animals dying over maybe even potentially a month. Depends on if they found a high point, how did they get away, what is the landmass doing, we don't know particularly. It doesn't say that they were all dead in 40 days. But what you do have is pulses of tsunamis as this year-long process is going on, where multiple events, multiple high points, multiple movements, multiple catastrophic things happening, where you have pulses of mud that sweep over different areas, creating, layers of animals dying at different times. It's not 40 days. And so this thing would have happened over a year, potentially even longer. Plus, after you have the waters receding later, that would have been another layer potentially of sedimentation happening. But the next part is, You talk about the fossil record, and I hear this all the time, like it's tight, it's perfect, it exactly fits what we need it to. That's just not true, Eric. There's issues in the fossil record. Again, I'm not going to talk about the lower part because I don't know. I'm not a paleontologist, and I've never been in there, but there's anomalous finds throughout the fossil record all the time. It is not airtight, including, and I would stress, you watch my video, everybody watch the video, dinosaurs at the surface. Dinosaurs can be at the surface, and they can be 600 feet deep. How do you explain dinosaurs, T-Rexes, being found 60 feet deep and then also at the surface? It's not this. We're shown the geologic column, and it's nice and it's clean. X amount of years, but it's not how it's actually. It's not how it is. It's not perfect like that. Like it is in the. The only way it's perfect like that, I hate to use a Kent Hovind line. The only place a geologic column is in a textbook. That's it. The only place you actually see that is in. Drawn in a textbook, and when there's issues, it's just not reported.
We draw diagrams to make a point, right? But again, just because like an old layer can be at the surface, there's nothing about the evolutionary or the conventional old Earth geological timeline that says that can't happen.
Right, but to say that your evidence is that our fossil record is nails, it's tight. The same kind of dinosaur can be 100 or 300 feet deep or at the surface. Whatever works.
When you find a rabbit in the belly of a T-Rex, that will be compelling. But saying that there are dinosaur fossils at the surface is not compelling.
Okay, I'm not even saying that finding dinosaurs at the surface is compelling, although I do think it is. I'm saying dinosaurs at the surface show that what you want there to be a rigid geologic column that fits with our theory, that isn't true. That's my point. It's not even that it's compelling. It's that it's not set in stone. It's arbitrary and subjective and situational at best.
Are fossils of mammals and dinosaurs like either fighting together or eating one another.
Yeah, I made a video about one. There's a Cetacosaurus and some mammal. They were fighting each other. And they're fossilized.
But one in China.
That probably there's China has really fine sediments, so a lot of extraordinarily good fossils are found there for that reason. Because the finer the sediment, the better the preservation. But again, mammals have been around since like the Triassic, maybe not quite that far back. I'm not 100% sure, but there's no problem with mammals and dinosaurs coexisting because it's not modern mammals and dinosaurs don't exist anymore.
Well, except for birds. And we would look at that and say, well, if it's fossilized, it died during the flood. And any mammals alive today are a descendant of one of the pairs that was on the ark. And just to finish off,
but is that what the evidence looks like? And I about really don't think so.
The flood timeline, based in Genesis, Genesis 7:11, fountains of the great deep broke apart, and windows of heaven were open. It began to rain. This happened on the 17th day of the second month. Noah entered the ark 7 days prior. Rain fell for 40 days. Water covered the earth's highest places at the time by over 20 feet. Began the stage of flooding until the next milestone. And then sometime between then and 150 days later is our next timestamp at the 7th month, 17th day of the month. The water rose to its highest level, covering the entire earth sometime between the 40th and 150th day. At the end of these 150 days... was when the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat on the 150th day. The springs of the great deep were no longer running. The rain buffs ceased. So, I mean, there's greater, it doesn't necessarily mean everything died within that the first 40 days, but, you could be having catastrophic death and burial within the beginning of this time frame. As things are being inundated.
Can I read from you one paragraph from my book, and then I want to hear your explanation for this. Is that okay?
Oh yeah, go for it.
Okay. This is the final paragraph in a section of my book where I address the claim that Noah's flood best explains the fossil record. Another glaring problem is the failure of this model to provide any reason why any marine organism would die in a flood. Oh no, more water. That's what we require to live. Marine organisms overwhelmingly dominate the fossil record, especially in the oldest and deepest layers. The first organisms to die in a global flood would be terrestrial ones. This means that the terrestrial organisms would dominate a preserved flood record in the oldest and deepest layers, the exact opposite of what we find.
It's a neat paragraph. That
who's the author? I have to know more about this guy.
Oh, I wouldn't say that's representative of the flood modeling that we're currently using. It might have worked good on like a is it Kent Hovind? No, I'm not thinking of Kent. Who's the other
Ken
guy?
Ham?
Ken Ham. That sounds like a good Ken Ham. It would destroy a Ken Ham argument, I guess. But the flood modeling we're using is the catastrophic plate tectonics. We're using mega tsunamis, which is inundating the land with water, burying the ecosystems that are being destroyed in it. Being the first ecosystem to be destroyed is the shallow marine life, as it's being dragged and dumped on land by some of the earliest floodquakes.
Why is that killing them? And, like, again, the waters only rose for a period of 40 days. So how is it that all marine life that's preserved, just give me a ballpark number. What percentage of the fossil record do you think represents organisms that died in the flood?
I'd say easily in the upper 90%.
Okay, so pretty much all of them. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
You need to explain, how did virtually... So the waters rise to their highest point in only 40 days, which means few days, all of the marine organisms that do die during this event die, become buried in deeper layers before any terrestrial organisms are affected by this flood.
Yeah. No, yeah,
why
that's
would
accurate.
Any marine organism die is one big problem.
So you're going from time zero to 40 days in. The majority of the damage is being done to the creatures that are they're living on the land masses. The water is at its zenith, at its highest point, yes, sometime between the 40th day and the 150th day. It's not that precise. So during that first 40 days, the beginning of the flood cataclysm, you're going to start to have your bigger earthquakes causing tsunamis. And the water that's coming into the land masses is going to be carrying along with its sediment, any of the shallow marine creatures that are being dragged up on land with it, with the very fast moving wave of water that's coming across the landmass. And then as that runs out of kinetic energy, it's going to regress. And we see this in observed tsunamis today, that the water will regress and it'll go back into the ocean basin. Now, at the beginning of the flood, maybe that first quake happens, dumping marine life, and then the next quake doesn't happen for a few days. And then maybe a few days later, the next one hits and it's bigger this time. And then maybe the next one happens a day later. And then after that, the next one a couple hours later, and then so on. And you're having larger ones hitting more frequently until eventually the land masses are completely covered in water 40 days in. Now, that first wave that hit, burying some shallow marine life, it has no way to escape.
It would kill land organisms. It would kill land organisms, too. How could a tsunami not kill land organisms? And yet, the oldest, deepest layers, which in your model would be the first things affected and killed by the flood, are exclusively marine organisms. It makes no sense.
It doesn't necessarily, because we're also talking like a matter of depth here, and the ecosystems that are on the planet at the time are not completely decimated yet, which means scavenging still an option. I'm thinking it's not a case closed, especially if that incoming tsunami wave did drag in marine life that got killed in that and stuck in the mud it was buried in. But anything bigger could have moved out of the area, you know, travel to higher ground, more inland, away from where that wave just came from.
That's just a statistical mechanism. You're giving me the odds, not...
You've got dinosaur footprints, though. That makes sense. If you've got a lot of these tidal flats around, as the water's receding back into the ocean basin and they're fleeing to higher ground, they'd be leaving dinosaur footprints behind
and
in their wake.
And elephant footprints and footprints of all forms of life. But we only find dinosaur footprints in that particular strata. But my question was, how can a tsunami that certainly would have killed animals living around the coast, like animals that live around the coast. Like there's lots of species of bird, for example, that populate our coasts and bears and things like that. Not a single terrestrial animal is found among the fossils of the first, like the oldest fossils in the fossil record. According to you, it's the first things to have been killed during the flood, which would have been marine things. According to me, it's also marine things, but like before any land animals like evolved, right? Our reading of the fossil record is that, yeah, the reason it looks that way is because these represent different eras of time where certain things never coexisted. I'm asking for an explanation for how is it that this flood has stratified the layers that way? Because it's, well, anyways.
Yeah, it's a fair question. So I think one of the, like, other than just giving you that, yeah, you know, it just looks like the lowest layers appear to only have marine fossils buried in them. How come I'm not finding like an accidental T-Rex buried with them, or like a, you know, human fossil or a mammal?
Yeah, or a human. Right. I don't know how many humans you think were alive, but current, like today, half of the world's population lives near the coast. So presumably, probably half the humans that died in this flood would have died in the first few days, because it takes 40, because we have only 40 days for this to occur. But yeah, we don't find a single human fossil mixed among these remains either.
We're also talking about a very different, if the history we have documented is to believed, these are extremely intelligent, darn near demigod level humans that are capable of living upwards of 1,000 years old, aren't going to go so easily.
That's just a statistical mechanism. There would have been helpless babies that couldn't do anything that would have been that would have fallen into this immediately, and there would have been elderly people. But again, when you just say, well, there like the crux of these arguments about, well, the reason I've heard arguments like, well, mammals are better swimmers, so yes, all the animals are dying at the same time because of the flood, but mammals can cling on to debris, and so they would have died last. That's just a statistical argument about why it would have the general pattern that it has, but it would never produce the absolute pattern that it has. That's too perfect.
I've been pushing back. I don't think it's an absolute pattern. It'd be a good idea for me to explore this more. That's actually a good place of research for me to get into.
No terrestrial organisms in any sediments before the, what would it be like? It'd be a little bit before the Permian, for example.
Well, didn't they find horse hoof footprints at the bottom of Grand Canyon?
In the sand? In the rock? Maybe? I don't know. But no, I don't think so. But also, a horseshoe print could be formed in myriad ways.
I'll see if I can dig that up.
They literally do horseback tours down there. Also, I'm doing this just for fun.
That's pretty good. So as you guys pull that up, what I would agree with, and we've talked about young Earth, old Earth quite a bit. There's evidence for old Earth. There's evidence for young Earth. I think the evidence leans our way, but whatever, no, even if it's 50-50. There's evidence for a flood.
I don't think it's 50-50. We can see billions of light years.
So no, that's not an issue.
Like if we
yes, it is.
No, it's not. It's
you have to appeal to a miracle for that not to be an issue.
We have no idea what the one-way speed of light is.
No. You don't have to appeal to a miracle for that not to be an issue, because we're assuming, like, so the light year issue, we don't know the speed of light in one direction. Like, we don't know that. We have to assume that. B, as far as like the initial causes of the Big Bang, right? And then the dark energy, dark matter are massive assumptions that we throw in to match the Big Bang model in order to do the light years as they
had a Big Bang model before we knew dark matter or energy existed.
But those were big gap fillers that we needed in order to make
explanations. No, we didn't. They're not required for the model to work at all.
How's the universe expanding?
How's the expansion accelerating?
I don't know.
Dark energy. That's the explanation.
So dark energy is the proposed mechanism for why the universe is accelerating in its expansion. Yeah. But we didn't know the universe was doing that until the 1990s. Right. The Big Bang model has been around since
when the Big Bang started falling apart.
Way much, 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 much longer than that.
We knew the universe was expanding prior to the Big Bang.
We knew the universe was expanding when we read the Bible.
No.
Well, you could say that, but that's... You could derive that.
So the Big Bang model was only... came up after we figured out that the universe is expanding, but dark energy wasn't part of it. It's not required for it.
Right, and it's totally made up.
It became a problem.
It's not made up. We have What do you mean? You think that scientists don't know that the rate at which the universe is expanding is accelerating?
Dark energy is made up. It's invoked to explain the expansion accelerating. They have no evidence for it. They have no idea what it is.
No. We don't know why the universe is accelerating in its expansion rate.
So they made up
the reason why is dark energy, and we don't pretend that we know what that is.
How can that be a reason why?
It's a placeholder for something we don't yet know.
It's entirely made up. Do things fall
to the ground?
Yes.
Yes.
Did we know why 500 years ago?
That's not analogous.
Yeah, it's the exact same thing. It is the exact same thing.
No.
Yes, so, it is. What do you mean no? We have an observed phenomena that the universe is expanding in its acceleration. It makes no sense to deny that. Why does it do that? We don't know. What we know is that energy is what makes things happen in this universe. So we don't know what it is, but probably some form of exotic energy or some, maybe it's just a property of space-time itself. We don't know. We call it dark energy because we admit that we don't know what it is. Right. But the universe is accelerating in its expansion. There must be a reason why. The reason, we will figure it out one day. We are currently calling it dark matter. When we figure out what it really is, we'll call it something else. Yeah. Like Darwin didn't know why organisms
have
the traits they have. He called it gemmicles, which is not correct. We now know it's genetics.
So that the problem there is dark, and we're assuming that it's some natural cause. We're assuming it's a natural cause, which is energy. But we are outside. In this instance, we would be outside of space, time, and matter. So
what? Something that is making the universe accelerate in its expansion must necessarily be outside of space, time, and matter?
Dark energy is.
What are you talking about?
Are we saying it's on like the inner rim of the outside edge of the universe, pushing it?
No, it's
we're saying it's outside of it, expanding it.
Correct? No, what? No, it's not something that's outside of the, it's not a tug of war. It's not something out on the edges of the universe pulling it apart. A lot of physicists think it's a property of space-time itself, which is like there's a funny thing about like the cosmological constant that Einstein got rid of, but now we think actually that might actually be an intrinsic part of space-time itself. But no, it's not something outside. But even if it was outside the observable universe, there's almost certainly just more universe outside the observable universe. It's just our horizon.
So funny you mentioned the horizon. That makes me think of the horizon problem. But there's this astrophysicist named Russ Humphreys. He has a very good model that would match with the young Earth creation timeline. Essentially, God had to make the universe in the way that it is now in order for life to exist, to be permitted.
That's an appeal to a miracle.
Well, same for the beginning of the expansion of the universe.
So is dark energy.
Dark energy is not a miracle.
Just saying it's not God doesn't mean it's not practice.
No, in what way is that a miracle?
Is expanding all of space, time, and matter as we know it.
It's 500 years ago. Why do things fall?
Because
that's the nature. That's its nature. That's like an Aristotelian argument, right? It's in things' nature to fall to the ground. That's just the way they were created, right?
So, is it possible that the universe could stop expanding?
I suppose.
Okay. Is it logically possible within the universe we live in now, would things function properly without gravity?
I don't know.
Like, it just seems less reasonable. Like, to make that comparison, it would be possible for maybe the universe to stop expanding. That's possible. Things could, you know, like, second law of thermodynamics entropy runs out of usable energy.
The point is, Luke claimed that secular scientists are appealing to a miracle because we don't know the explanation for why the universe is accelerating in its expansion.
That's actually not how this happened. How it happened is you talked about dark energy being a thing, and I said they made up dark energy. You said, no, they didn't make up dark energy.
It's not made up. We know the universe is accelerating in its expansion.
It's made up.
We don't know that dark energy is the cause.
No. Pause. Do you deny the observed, I was going to say observed fact. Let me just not be so arrogant, I guess. Do you deny the astronomical data that tells us that the universe is accelerating in its expansion.
I do not deny that, no.
Do you know why it does that?
Do I know why the expansion is accelerating? Here's what I know.
Neither do secular scientists, but we have to say, we're going to say something's responsible for it, and we just say it's dark energy.
Right. So what do we do when we can't use science to make a determination?
We can use... Okay, what makes you say we can't use science just because it's not known yet? Science is how we've discovered everything about the natural world. Except for dumb things like this thing is brown. I mean, I wouldn't really call that science, but...
Or where the universe came from.
You had to know philosophy and you had to know math and logic before you could even do science. So
science has answered very little.
I think science has answered a lot. But you can do science without math. So if we didn't know math...
You can do science without math. You can do science strictly based on observations. I mean, you can do experiments without math.
I would say that science presupposes math, logic, and philosophy. Like, you have to have... You could say some scientific experiments, you don't need math. But we have to have at least logic and philosophy. That was the precursor to
logic,
science.
Well, logic is just part of the mentalese, the mental language about how we even operate in a universe. I don't really want to have a philosophical discussion about logic, but this dark energy thing, I'm so confused.
So this is
what
I'm trying to say, right? So now we have to jump to philosophy because we can't use the scientific method to observe something
something we can't observe.
About something we can't observe. Yeah, that I was
We used to not know how to observe the tissue inside the human body, but eventually, accidentally, X-rays were discovered. Fun fact, the first person to win a Nobel Prize won the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery of the X-ray. Now you know. And he thought he was insane when he saw the first X-ray, by the way. But then we developed the positron emission tomography scan or the PET scan or whatever, and MRIs. I kind of forgot what you said, but it's like you're saying, well, we don't have the answer, therefore we can't appeal to science for the answer. Science exists. Scientific discoveries occur on the precipice of what isn't yet known. We learn new things through doing science.
Mm-hmm. So can we physically observe this dark energy?
Not yet. We used to not be physically able to observe the tissue inside of a human body. But you can watch through an ultrasound. You can see a person's beating heart now. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to think that it can't be done by science.
I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying at the moment, it cannot be done.
Right.
In the future, it's possible it can be done.
This all just started with you saying that we knew what dark energy was, and I said that you have no idea what dark energy is. It's entirely a rescuing device.
This actually started because somebody said that we created dark energy and dark matter to make the Big Bang work, which is completely false. Those things were the observations that led to our hypotheses or whatever. They're not even hypotheses. Well, we have some hypotheses about what they are. They're just placeholders for what we don't yet understand.
So it was how we fixed the problem. The question, well, how do we know?
No, it didn't fix the problem. The Big Bang model was around in the 1930s and 40s.
Yes.
And then was was really definitively confirmed in 1965 or whatever it was with the CMB.
Yes.
Dark energy and dark matter were not ever used to fix something. What you could say is that inflation is used to fix discrepancies.
Yes. It is
but
also
we
used,
don't
yes.
know. Scientists are honest that we don't know if cosmic inflation happened or if it did happen, how did it happen or whatever. It's an idea that's out there. But dark matter and dark energy were not thrown into the Big Bang to make it work.
Well, if they weren't there, then it wouldn't work. You need some
That's not true because the Big Bang tells us we live in a universe that expands, that doesn't create new matter.
The Bible.
And that began about 14 billion years ago.
Not what the Bible says.
So what I'm saying is if you don't have dark energy, or you don't have dark matter, the Big Bang is, that has problems, and that's why they came up with dark energy and dark matter as solutions for the problems that existed at that time. And same with inflation. That's why Guth came up with inflation, because the horizon problem. So, and
but inflation, Newton didn't know why gravity even worked.
Okay.
General relativity explains that.
So my whole point was just to say, okay, now we have to rely on philosophy, because we can't do the scientific method as we truly need to. If you can't observe something, you can't do the scientific method. You really can't. You have to be able to observe it to a certain extent.
You don't even believe that. We can't observe black holes. We can't observe atoms. You don't even believe this.
You can observe that on a better scale than you can dark energy.
Well, currently, I guess. Well, I mean, I don't know if I even agree with that. Like,
so if
we can observe the effects that dark energy has very clearly.
We can observe the effect that there must be something.
The something's happening.
That's expanding the universe at an accelerated rate. There must be something. We're going to say it's dark energy, right? And it's funny you mentioned inflation, because I could say on the young Earth model that with inflation, well, why didn't inflation just go super fast for a very brief moment, right? And then stop to where
this
the universe
is in my
would
book.
Appear.
You want me to read it?
You cover this young Earth argument for inflation?
Yes.
All right, read it. Let me hear what you said.
Okay.
Let me hear what you
said. Where is it? Where the heck is it? The moon, Noah's flood, rapid
flood. I have no idea.
Oh, it must be in the Big Bang section. Yep, there we go. Okay. How long is this? I don't want to be boring. And well, it is a little over 1.5. It's about 1.5 pages. How many words is it?
Just read it, man.
It's 865 words. Okay. I'll go quickly.
And I will hold the microphone right here.
No.
Perfect.
I'm not going to do that. If cosmic inflation lasted longer than if cosmic inflation lasted longer, a 6,000-year-old universe would look just like our current universe. This claim could, introduction paragraph doesn't matter. Space appears to be incredibly uniform, no matter where we look. In other words, the distribution of matter is basically the same in every direction. While it's true there can be millions of light years between galaxies, when you zoom out to billions of light years, the universe is a uniform sea of galaxies and galaxy clusters. Scientists aren't sure why this is. Although space is expanding, gravity still attracts objects together. If space had expanded at a rate we see today in its earliest moments, then gravity would have clumped matter into much larger superstructures than we see today. In turn, we would also observe enormous voids in space where there is no matter. There are voids in our current universe. One of the largest is the Boots Void, 330 million light years across. Yet, that is less than a third of 1% of the diameter of our observable universe. The leading hypothesis for why the matter in the universe did not clump together to a greater extent than is observed today is cosmic inflation. To make a long story short, the universe expanded much faster than the speed of light for an insanely brief time. We're talking about growing by a factor of 10 to the 26th, between 10 to the negative 36th and 10 to the negative 32nd seconds after time zero. That is the equivalent, this rapid expansion dispersed matter in a way that it could not form voids and instead produced a universe that is uniform in its distribution of matter. Okay, now allow me to restate the counterargument in a little more detail. The universe could just as easily be only a few thousand years old. If cosmic inflation lasted much longer, the universe would have expanded to its current size and appear just as it does today. The only thing this counter-argument gets right is that the universe would be the same diameter it is today. If cosmic inflation had lasted longer, the structure of matter in the universe would be nothing like what we see today. Remember that under the Big Bang model, inflation lasted only 10 to the negative 34 seconds. To express that as a percentage of the history of the universe, you need 42 zeros after the decimal. It has taken gravity the rest of that time to form galaxies and galaxy clusters that we see. But under this young Earth universe model, there would be nowhere near enough time for any large scale object
to
form.
Just cut that out of the book, that last whole part.
Okay. It's scientific. Even though the universe expands faster than the speed of light, 6,000 years is such a short time that there would be no significant difference in the size of the universe after this longer inflation happened and today. This model gives us an observable universe over 90 billion light years across just after inflation, which then grows by less than 10,000 light years in the ensuing time between then and now. That is a growth of 0.0000001%. Now here's the big issue. Cosmic inflation causes the universe to expand faster than gravity can attract mass together. This is not a problem in the Big Bang model because cosmic inflation was so brief. After the brief expansion, the universe continued expanding, but at a pace that was slow enough that over billions of years, gravity collected matter into stars, galaxies, and galaxy clusters. But in this young universe model, the observable universe became over 90 billion light years across almost immediately. Gravity could not have caused any large-scale structures to have formed since then under this view. Not only would we not have galaxy clusters or galaxies, but there wouldn't even be stars. So that is not the end, but that is the only relevant part, I think.
Adam. Okay, thank you. You've been talking. Yeah, this is hard for me. Okay, so that whole thing at the end there with we needed time for galaxies to form and all that shit, just if you haven't published the book, cut it out. Because we have zero evidence of any galaxy formation. Zero evidence of nucleosynthesis to the level we would have needed it. None of that stuff is, it's all out. We had a model and then they took pictures and they found that everything was fully formed. I mean, you could say it if you want to, it's just not scientifically accurate. There's no current model for understanding cosmic evolution. Everything they thought they knew is out. We see fully formed galaxies. That's it. Massive fully formed galaxies. So I just cut that out. The next thing is you mentioned the other part of it that's totally inaccurate. We expected this isotropic universe. It was all going to be, you know, homogeneous. Everything was going to be this certain way that would prove the Big Bang, except for the axis of evil, which I'm sure you know about the axis of evil. Do you know about the axis of evil?
Okay. I've heard about then this, but now I can't remember what it is.
That's okay. I'm just going to read it to you because, like, other than that whole thing, I mean, it's written well. It's just scientifically inaccurate. I'm going to read this to you here. Flip camera. This is space.com. This isn't Answers in Genesis. I never use any creationist websites. I do like Jason Lyle, but anyways, I don't use any of the creationist websites. Okay, here we go. Earth is mediocre, but not in the way you might think. Food is bland, blah, 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 blah. The Earth does not enjoy a special vantage point in the universe. There's simply nothing special about a particular location. Thank you, Carl Sagan, for speaking to us from the dead. That's obviously his whole thing, pale blue dot. We orbit a typical star and typical spiral galaxy and a typical branch of a typical supercluster. Our planet is, and its evolutionary leap to intelligent beings could have occurred in any old spot around the cosmos, although we don't see any evidence of intelligence anywhere else anyways. And we ought to have to come to the same conclusion about the big science questions, the Big Bang, dark energy, cosmic web, the works, etc. The principle of mediocrity, also sometimes dubbed the Copernican principle, is an effort to salvage our ego, is baked into the very mathematics that cosmologists use to understand and model the universe. This is what you were saying. Simple, it's just exactly what we would predict, nothing special about the universe, nothing special about the Earth, yada, yada. But there's a problem. When it comes to cosmology, two assumptions make the difference between a world of math pain and math paradise, that our universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Homogeneous means that it's at big enough scales. One patch of the universe is roughly like any other patch, what you said in your book. Obviously, you have to go beefy into enough scales to make this work. For example, the Earth is very different than the Sun. For our universe, that happens around 200 million light years. Isotropic means that cosmos look pretty much the same no matter where, what direction you look in. Again, over sufficiently large distances. I can almost be reading this from your book, very similar to what you said. With these two assumptions in place, the math of general relativity is slightly less torturous and progress, confirming them with experimental whatever data can be made. But being good little scientists, not only do astronomers test their hypotheses, but they also test their assumptions. Is the universe really homogeneous and isotropic? CMBR is a relic of the early universe. We know about this. The light surrounds us on all sides. Okay, what a wonderful testbed for our cosmological assumptions. We can ask, is the universe isotropic? To the CMB, and it can answer. The response, yes, the CMB is perfectly uniform across all the sky to one part in 10,000. Mission accomplished.
Point for me.
But the devil, as they say, is in the details. There are subtle, tiny differences in the temperature of the CMB light from place to place. Those minuscule variations offer a wealth of information on many pressing cosmological questions, like the geometry of the universe, the amount of dark matter, and the growth of the larger structures. To mathematically quantify the statistical properties of the CMB's characteristics, bumps, and wiggles, cosmologists turn to a technique called multipole expansion. This expansion looks at even smaller patches of the sky and analyzes the variations at only that scale. Sorry, we're almost there. First scale is the monopole, second is the dipole, quadpole, yada, yada, yada. We'll just go down here. Except for the quadrupole and octopole, which are just a few degrees away from each other, this coincidence was first noticed by NASA's early WMAP mission, but many dismissed it as a statistical fluke that would surely go away with better instruments. It did not go away with better instruments, and it gets worse. It seems that the CMB is slightly cooler when viewed through the top half of our solar system and slightly warmer on the opposite side. I'm not talking much, just a handful of microkelvin difference, but it's measurable and definitely there. Plus, this particular relationship, a peculiar relationship to our solar system, is aligned with the quadrupole and the octopole. That's odd. It's one thing for two of the multipoles to be aligned. Maybe that's just random coincidence, but it's another for them to be associated with our solar system, hence the nickname of Axis of Evil. I missed a part here. Sorry. When I was reading through this, I skipped this part. The dipole's hot patch may be over there, but the octopole should be directly over there with no connection between them. As it turns out, there are, from the 2-pole to the 4,000 pole, the ESA's space agency verified that all the multipoles point in all sorts of random directions except for the ones that point to our solar system. I know that's a lot. I tried to skim over it, but there are...
What did that prove?
There are... I missed this part of it that's important because as I was trying to read through this, but this is... This part of it where I'm just going to read this one more time. I know it's like, you know, it's very boring and nerdy stuff, but the first scale is the average CMB temperature across the whole sky, the monopole. The second is the dipole, or the two hemispheres. The next is the quadrupole, the sky cut into quadrants, then the octopole, etc. The total CMB signal is the sum of all these contributions of various sizes, and in the isotropic universe, these should all have random orientations. The dipole's hot patch may be hot over there, but the octopole should be directed over there with no connections between them. It turns out that they are, except for the quadrupole and octopole, which are a few degrees away from each other. The coincidence was first noted by WMAP. Many dismiss it as a statistical fluke that would go away with better measurements, but it didn't go away.
But what does this prove?
There is this
rare... Or suggest?
It's suggesting that there is data in the CMB that orients three vertices with our solar ecliptic, basically our solar system. It should be totally isotropic and homogeneous, but it's not. There are actual orientations of CMB data that align with our solar system. I can find a better article to explain it more particularly. Let's see.
Therefore,
it flies in the face of the idea that it's homogeneous and isotropic.
It doesn't. It said the discrepancies were a few microkelvin.
I'm gonna have to find a better one that explains it a little better.
That didn't really make any kind of point. Earlier, I did something to my microphone. Is my voice like clipping really badly?
No.
Okay, then it's just my headphones. So earlier everything that I read was to, like, even if you don't agree with cosmic inflation, that wasn't the point. The point was, you cannot co-opt cosmic inflation to explain the way you think things are, because, what I read, I think, demonstrated that. I don't want to relitigate it or whatever. I mean, I can talk about it later if you want. But earlier when I said that, like, you're appealing to miracles and you said no, well, there's this guy named Danny Faulkner.
No. I know Danny Faulkner. He's the CMI and Is Genesis History astrophysicist. He's a young Earth creationist. But I didn't say no. I said that the naturalist has to do the same thing. They just don't invoke God.
No.
They invoke the natural miracle.
I very strongly disagree with that. And we already talked for 30 minutes about our dark energy and dark matter appeals to miracles. I don't want to relitigate that. But I thought you said no. But he literally says this. I mean, there's this very long article that he wrote about the problem of light, solving the light travel time problem. And he has an actual PhD in astrophysics from what I understand. And he goes through all kinds of different explanations, proposed explanations. Has the speed of light changed? And he talks about how, no, that doesn't actually make any sense. Are there things in general relativity we can look to? And he goes over and says, no. In the end, this is what he says. Could God similarly have rapidly brought forth the light of the stars on day 4 so that they could fulfill their promise? Note that I am not suggesting this was done through the physics of general relativity or by altering physics so that the speed of light changes. Rather, I'm suggesting that God miraculously brought the light to Earth from the farthest reaches of the universe right after he filled the universe with astronomical bodies. So they are appealing to a miracle. He's saying, yes, the universe is billions of light years across, and the light was just immediately brought to us. Meaning that he's admitting that everything about the way we know science works would tell us that this would make the universe look very old. It's not a flawed assumption to say that based on what we know about the known laws of physics, we would say that the universe is this big, therefore it would take this light this long to reach us. He's saying that all actually does hold water. He's just saying, because he believes the Earth is only a few thousand years old, this is the only answer that he can accept for why it looks the way it does, despite the physical evidence and the conventional science. I drank all my wine.
Attaboy.
Too bad for you.
Oh man! Well, I got about a dozen more bottles in the fridge. But
what are you drinking, by the way?
So, if you do you get National Geographic?
No.
They do like a wine voucher thing. So it's called Tour of the World or something. So you can get a subscription where you like get a box of wine every like 4 months or something, and it's actually extremely good.
Is it old?
When you first get it, you get like $100 off. It's like this insane value. So if you want, and they're very, very good. So if you want, DM me, and they always send me coupon codes for it, but I already have a subscription, so I can't use them. So I will send you the code so you can get it, and you'll get a box of wine all from like Europe, and they're extremely good. So
I have a wine shop near me that I can get a 2016 cab Sauvignon for like, depending on the brand. If it's from France, it'll be like $30. But I like.
I can get you a dozen bottles for like $80
of like a 2016 cab.
Not quite that, but on average, each bottle is like it's like $12 or $15 on average for bottle. Like it's a really good deal. That's all.
I just like the older the better, especially with red wines. Like that's my thing. But anyway,
absolutely fair.
Sorry for
the distraction. Okay, I want to read this really quick. So this is not a creation's website. That last one kind of dodged around it a little bit. I would encourage you, Eric, to look into it honestly before you publish that thing in the book, because you should at least know that this is a phenomenon that science is having a hard time explaining. So look into it more, find a better source than the first one I had. But some believe it's just a figment of overactive imaginations, but evidence is growing that the so-called axis of evil, a pattern apparently imprinted on the radiation left behind by the Big Bang, may be real, posing a threat to standard cosmology. According to the standard model, the universe is isotropic. You said that in your book, that's why I brought it up, or much the same everywhere. The first sign of that this might not be the case came in 2005 when Kate Land and this guy of Imperial College London noticed a curious pattern in the map of the cosmic microwave background radiation. It seemed to show that some hot and cold spots in the CMB are not distributed randomly as expected, but are aligned along what Majuro dubbed the axis of evil. Some astronomers have suggested the straightforward explanations for the axis, such as problems with the instrumentation, but others, they improve the instrumentation and they see it. So there's still a fair bit of controversy about whether there's even something that needs to be explained. I'm just encouraging you to look into the axis of evil. As of now, there is some sort of phenomena that flies in the face of isotropic, homogeneous CMBR, and it seems to, of all things, be oriented in at least two axes, if not three, to our solar ecliptic, in particular to our solar system. So I would want to look into that. The next thing, let me see if I can get this turned around really quick, is the Earth, the Big Bang is fine. Like, maybe we close on this because I know it's getting late.
I have one more question, and then my eyes hurt so bad.
Yeah, it was the Big Bang model, rapid expansion, where the use of the universe is expanding. Where does this come from? They find redshift. Redshift says the light is streaking away from us. As it goes away, it's losing its energy. So it's in the red spectrum. Therefore, we know it's shifting. Hubble tried to convince Einstein. Einstein said it was abominable. Finally, him and Lemaître convinced Einstein we've accepted the Big Bang model. In this, we made some predictions. If the universe was expanding, as we measure the rate, it should be at the same speed or even slowing down. This is what you would predict. This is how physics works. You have an explosion, a rapid expansion. That expansion would be steady in a vacuum or slowing down. Turns out that the expansion is accelerating. This was a problem. Instead of going, maybe our theory's wrong, we said, hey, dark energy, whatever this is, we don't know. Then they predicted to find proto-galaxies forming. They predicted you'd have nucleosynthesis, then those would explode, and then you'd get the heavier elements, then you'd get the starting, heavier elements forming together, and then planetoids, and then an early galaxy, and the galaxies would clash into each other, collision theory, and then eventually you get a bigger galaxy, and this would take, billions of years potentially. So when they looked back in time with the James Webb and expected to see proto-galaxies, they found fully formed galaxies, and this is, if the Big Bang had any merit, had some merit, I guess, between the expansion accelerating and the fully formed galaxies, they will come up with a better theory. We're in the dark ages of science right now. Secular scientific bias, they're going to look back at what we taught right now 500 years from now and go, hey, I can't believe they believe that shit. That's crazy. And one of them is going to be the Big Bang. Sure, they want to blow it up, add more time, whatever. At this point, we see a fully mature universe that's expanding, which corroborates with our book. God created the universe, and he said...
Yeah, it's an appeal to a miracle.
Oh, yeah, but I can appeal to miracles. Because I have a God that does miracles.
Well, you can't justify them, though.
My point is both sides have to. Well, ask your question, and let me make a point afterwards, so we can hop off.
So, because of the axis of evil... That's so funny. Because I think of... North Korea, Iran, and Afghanistan, or whatever. Right.
Scientists, they literally name that because they're like, "This, I don't like this. This flies in the face of our theory, and this is evil." They made it up because they didn't like it.
So let's say that, like, we know we live in an expanding universe, whether or not you think it's only a couple thousand years old or a dozen billion years old or whatever. We agree on that aspect of it. This data does not indicate that we don't live in a universe that expands. Okay.
Right.
So you're not arguing against me yet. So I guess basically my question is, in what way does any of this evidence point to, therefore God created the universe?
Oh, an easy question.
So
go ahead, Adam.
This is part of like what I wanted to bring up was the problem is we have to, like, this is, and I'm a philosophy person, so I'm sorry for always mixing it in with science, but it's kind of required when we have so many questions that we still don't, like, nobody in science is going to say, I know what caused the Big Bang to begin. Nobody's going to say that because we don't have a scientific explanation for that. You have somebody like maybe Lawrence Krauss will try to and say it came from nothing, even then say nothing is not actually nothing. But anyways, you have to, as the naturalist, you have to appeal to a miraculous claim. Space, time, and matter began to expand with no intelligent cause or so the causal agent for this was space, time, and matter, which just seems
no. I don't know what caused it, and I offer no hypothesis for what caused it.
But the reason that the naturalist will say that is because you don't have an option other than natural means, and we have no naturalistic explanation that would like compete with a theistic explanation. That's why it's always, I don't know.
Every unanswered scientific question that's ever existed always had an as of yet unsolved explanation.
Yeah, and it was presumed to be some
naturalistic explanation. And we have, I couldn't count how many of those answers we have today.
Where the universe came from, where the moon came from, where life came from. We still have no answers to any of these questions. Difficult.
Well, no, so I think the biggest questions would be your origin of the universe, origin of consciousness, origin of life, and then the foundation for morality. Morality is not a scientific question, so that doesn't matter.
Well, it's subjective, so.
Well, that you may say that, but I would disagree, but that's a different argument.
Well, having a stance on, like, having a philosophical position about morality is subjective. That's what I mean.
Well, I'm just saying, like, without getting into the realism versus anti-realism argument, that's irrelevant to science. Science has nothing to do with ethics. But
sure,
as far as that, I
can totally agree with.
Right. So but as far as the origins of the universe, origins of life and consciousness, we're stuck with philosophical arguments because we don't have a naturalistic way to explain it, which science would be able to give us more information. We might in the future, like even James Torr will say he's a, you know, Christian scientist. Now he says he's 100% philosophically naturalist when he does his work. And I would take him for his word on that. He says we're at best 500 years out from the origin of life, like determining how that happened on a prebiotic. Cause the more we learn, the farther away we get.
But even if I agreed with this, and I'm not sure if I agree with it.
Okay.
Why is this a problem? Like some sort of question isn't yet answered. So we have to appeal to philosophy. I mean, do you think that when somebody does the scientific method, they are appealing to philosophy? And for some, there's something wrong with that?
No, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. But the original thing was you were saying that we have to appeal to a miracle. Because as a theist, right, you have to do the same thing just without a God, because there has to be some sort of beyond naturalistic explanation.
If we find it a naturalistic explanation for something, it was never a miracle. And science doesn't presume a miracle is the explanation for something, because you couldn't scientifically test a miracle.
No, what I'm saying is you have to appeal to a miraculous start to the expansion of the universe.
No, I don't.
At the moment. Oh, you can say I don't know, because your only other option is something miraculous. So you stick
I reject that miracles even exist, though. And I don't think in the spirit of science you would ever accept a miracle as an explanation for anything. Before we knew why things fell to the ground, I guess people maybe thought that that's because the way things were created.
Can I just define miracle really quick? A highly improbable or extraordinary event, development, or accomplishment that brings very welcome consequences. You don't think you believe the universe coming from nothing was a miracle?
So a literal miracle is the action of some sort of supernatural agent.
No, there's,
to me.
Here's another one. An amazing product or achievement or an outstanding example of something.
Yes, when we miracle say miraculous. Yes, right. We all have loose associations with words. If miracle is going to stand alone as its own word, that means its own thing, what does it mean? For me, and you can tell me if you agree with this or not, a miracle is the action of some sort of supernatural agent that cannot be explained.
That's not at all the definition of a miracle.
I would say it would be better to add like miracle from God, because it would be fair to say that it's miraculous that a child walks across a busy highway in LA on non-traffic day, six lanes, just flying cars, right? And somehow this child avoids hitting a car.
Yes, but it could happen. We don't need to assume that its guardian angel literally changed the course of events in the real world to make it happen. So it's not a literal miracle. It's miraculous.
That's what I'm saying, though, is there is a miracle invoking God, and then there's a miracle just being highly improbable naturalistically. And so this is why I don't like when people say, well, you have to invoke a miracle. Well, at the moment, so does the naturalist. It's just a non-theistic miracle, a highly, highly improbable event taking place.
Right.
Whereas,
and it's
funny,
highly
funny
improbable
enough, though,
things happen all the time.
But funny enough, though, on theism, it's actually not highly improbable. It's a one-to-one.
I don't know what you mean by that. If you mean that I believe in an infinite God that can do anything, that literally explodes the ability for it to explain anything at all.
So no, all it does is it raises the probability, like in the worldview perspective.
But
is a one to one.
So if you say the thing I believe in can do anything, you're sort of right, but at the same time, it explains literally nothing. Because if it could have done anything, there's no way of saying, there's no way of determining, oh, it did this thing and not this
thing.
Because at the end of the day, you could just say, oh, well, it did this. Or then when we change our mind, it could have also done that, because it can literally do anything. It has zero explanatory value.
I wouldn't want to offer just a god did it. I would rather try to offer it with explanatory power. But I just was merely speculating on the probability. That's literally all it was addressing.
And let's talk about the probability real fast. And I hate to go into philosophy as well, but in this discussion, when we try to invoke like the most reasonable answer, something you can do is a thought experiment. You can go, okay, we've seen this kind of thing. It does this. Maybe if the laws are consistent, this would explain the thing I'm trying to figure out. When I talk about the simulation argument, if you try to explain the Nintendo or Minecraft coming about through natural processes, code did this and this. If you're in the game Minecraft and you go, well, you know what? I think this happened naturally. I don't know exactly where our universe came from or where the information came from, but I think eventually we're going to figure out that it was totally a random thing. Certainly wasn't an agent outside of this reality that had the resources necessary to create this reality. And all of these kind of assumptions would be almost, they'd be laughable with you and me in Minecraft trying to explain the coding and how this works without a programmer. To say, I think there's a mind outside of this reality, because it would have been necessary for this reality to exist, that there was something pre-existing it that had the means and the agency to create this, that's a logical deduction. In the game Minecraft, you'd be dead on, and anything to the contrary naturalist would be kind of ridiculous. So looking at it in that reference, we're having this discussion, and you're going, yeah, but if God could create anything, he could create anything. Okay, well, in Minecraft, Michael Person or Marcus Person, he could create 10 video games. That doesn't delegitimize that Marcus Person created the Minecraft reality. And when you start thinking about what the Earth looks like, okay, from Minecraft, you could never know what the actual Earth looks like. It could be a simulation of it or in the image of it, but you'd be like, well, what is there? It's flesh and blood, and they're in the universe and whatever. Well, that can't be, because in our Minecraft reality, we don't see it. That's not going to, it's also not going to delegitimize this idea. The most cogent idea for where anything would come from, especially when you deal with something like information or what looks to be clear design, is a designer. And the only way that can happen is this with the universe is that the designer isn't in the universe, subject to the universe. So immediately you have logically an entity outside of the universe with the capability of creating a universe as at least a viable option, if not the most logical option. It beats the shit out of, fuck, maybe the universe created itself, maybe it didn't, maybe it's always been here, we don't know, or a miracle. It's science of the gaps. And to say, we will figure it out, says that you just, science is your religions, and we've got our priests, and they're going to come up with this thing. It's totally punting or appealing to authority. We'll figure it out. Give us some time. Well, you've had a lot of time. You've had the
whole
thing.
That's not an appeal to authority.
And we're nowhere closer. And everything they figure out, they think they figure something out, and it turns out they're wrong.
Well,
in biogenesis, where the universe comes from the Big Bang.
And so this is also, I don't typically argue, like Luke and Dan are a little bit different than me. I will argue for theism through like a philosophical argument prior to getting to young earth creationism. They're better at the science aspect than I am. I think it's far more difficult to do it that way. I think it's easier to go for the argument to prove theism, or at least to convince someone theism is more probable. And then from there, you can argue, all right, well, which theistic belief is true? Christianity. And then if Christianity is true, how do we take Genesis? Well, this is why I would take Genesis this way. Because not only does Scripture seem to back it as far as like the literal interpretation, the other interpretations don't seem to have as strong of an impact. Also, the scientific evidence could also explain a young earth creation model. So I know for you, you are a science teacher. This is your thing. You are a science guy. So that's... science is going to be the most important thing to you. But that's why my approach probably won't be as strong as somebody like Luke's or Dan's in that regard, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Okay, let me do a closing argument. Eric, we've been debating for almost 2 years now. I don't know if you know that, a year and a half anyways, from our first debate till now. When we first debated, the universe was locally real and the Big Bang was in good shape. I've had a good year. I've had a really good year in my industry. And fuck, dude, man, I expect it to only get better. Like, I don't know how you guys are holding on to this thing, man. That's a big couple blows to the theory. And what both of
None
those
of that
things
points to God, though.
Yes, it does. It does.
No,
because
it doesn't.
The book that we believe was authored by the creator of this universe
says nothing
exactly
about local reality.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, jeez.
How would you explain this reality? It's contrived by God from God's mind we're here temporarily. There was something outside of this reality. I mean, I guess if you want to say,
you're presupposing that that's what the people that wrote that story meant. You're reading their words in a very modern and enlightened lens.
Presupposing it was people that wrote that story,
huh?
You're presupposing it was people that wrote that story.
Right. The Anunnaki who wrote that story. The Nephilim who wrote that story.
God, it's God's
Moses
account,
would have been the author of Genesis.
Yeah, Moses dictating exactly what God said about the creation of this. It wasn't Moses making up a story. He was on Sinai. If the story is to be believed, God was telling him what to say. The point is, real reality is eternity and wherever God is. We are here temporarily for a certain amount of time to be judged, basically, what I call a free will simulation. And when we're dead and gone, we go back to eternity to be judged by God. The idea of the universe not being locally real is all over the Bible. Jesus was healing people remote. He was respawning characters. He said, none of this is real.
The respawning characters.
Okay. He respawned. Well, all right.
Dude,
well,
it's like,
look, I need, my eyes hurt. I said this 30 minutes ago. My eyes hurt so bad.